You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford with a March 15th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. That schedule, as you can hear, is not etched in stone, since this happens to be the third Wednesday this month, the Ides of March, in fact, when you would ordinarily expect to hear Forthright Radio with host Joy LeClaire, with whom I occasionally switch dates, as we have this month. This means I'll be back with you again in my usual slot next week, as well as the following Wednesday, the fifth of the month, at which time I will duly open the phones to get your takes on the world, an event that seems popular with many listeners. In my opening news and commentary when I was last with you, that was back on February 22nd, I pointed out that it was the third anniversary of the U.S. orchestrated coup in Ukraine, the day that the country's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, was forced to flee for his life from the capital, Kiev, after armed Ukrainian neo-Nazis had seized the initiative over the protest in Maidan Square. That moment in time, I pointed out, has been as effectively erased from history as it is being told in the United States, as has the efforts of the Democratic National Committee to undermine the chances of Senator Bernie Sanders to defeat the Democrats' anointed candidate, Hillary Clinton, for the party's presidential nomination. I spent a good time of my time, good part of my time, railing against those who can best be described as liberals, both individuals and organizations, that supported Clinton, who have been unceasing in their efforts to blame Russia, and particularly his president, Vladimir Putin, for defeat by Donald Trump. And my guest that day, Dutch journalist Carol van Wolfenen, also had much to say in the same vein on the subject. To make my points both about the U.S. role in Ukraine and the wrongheadedness of trying to pin Trump's victory on Putin, I played three sound clips. The first was of a secretly recorded conversation, probably by the Russians, between U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeff Pyatt about who should become the next prime minister of the country after the fall of Yanukovych that took place 2 weeks before it happened, an audio from a video of Senator Lindsey Graham and John McCain speaking to Ukrainian troops this past December, encouraging them to go on the offensive against Russia this year, and being and Dennis Kucinich, former congressman, a voice of sanity, being interviewed on Fox News, warning about the dangers of the growing anti-Russian hysteria. My hopes that it would go away, that I could focus on something else 3 weeks later, turned out to be unfounded. Situation has, in fact, grown worse, with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, who I failed to include in my initial rogues gallery, playing the role of Senator Joe McCarthy in pushing the ongoing anti-Russian witch hunt. Whether this campaign by liberals such as Maddow, pushing what is essentially the neocons' agenda regarding Russia, is being done because they think it may be the only way to get rid of Putin, or reflects something deeper and darker on their part, is hard to know at this point. What is clear, however, is that it is reckless, it is dangerous, and without question, intellectually dishonest. It will be the subject of what I will be discussing later in the program with award-winning journalist Robert Perry of Consortium News, whose two articles over the last week and a half, The Politics Behind Russiagate and When Disinformation is Truth, published Monday, explores the problem. That will be 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. The issue of intellectual dishonesty on this issue came to mind after coming across a reference to Victoria Nuland's conversation with Ambassador Pyatt about who should become the next Ukrainian prime minister as the pressure increased on Yanukovych, the one that I played for you, in a lengthy article in the March 6th New Yorker, written by its longtime editor, David Resnick, Evan Osnos, and Joshua Yaffet. It was entitled Trump, Putin, and the New Cold War. Here's how the New Yorker literati described it. Quote, as tensions with Russia rose over the conflicts in Ukraine and Syria in early 2014, the U.S. was stung by a comment in Moscow politics, the weaponized leak. While the U.S. and the European Union discussed the details of a potential transitional government in Ukraine, an aide to the Russian deputy prime minister tweeted a reference to part of a wiretap conversation posted soon afterward to YouTube between Victoria Nuland, a U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, and her colleague Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine. Nuland is heard saying, F bleep the EU, unquote, a line that the Russians knew would cause difficulties between the Americans and the EU counterparts. The State Department, said the New Yorker writers, called the leak, a, quote, a new low in Russian tradecraft, end quote. Asked what form of penalty was extracted from Russia, Michael McFaul, the ambassador to Moscow during the Obama administration, said, quote, to the best of my knowledge, there was none. I think that was a mistake, end quote. That was from the New Yorker. What the authors deliberately left out was the most significant part in which Nuland tells Pyatt who she wants to be Ukraine's prime minister, namely Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who they refer to as Yats, and that a popular Maidan protest activist, former world heavyweight champion Vitaly Klitschko, who they refer to as Klitsch, should stay out of it. In publishing the transcript of their conversation while Yanukovych was still in office, the BBC's Jonathan Marcus noted that, quote, while the U.S. says that it is, quote, ultimately is up to the Ukrainian people to decide their future, this transcript, says Marcus, suggests that the U.S. has a very clear idea about what the outcome should be and is striving to achieve these goals, end quote. Somehow this effort by Washington at generating regime change was not considered noteworthy by the New Yorker editor and his cohorts because it clearly contradicted the thrust of their article. And by the way, of course, Yatsenyuk got the job as prime minister. Well, if that's not intellectually dishonest, I don't know what is. In the meantime, neocon heavyweight, literally and figuratively, Robert Kagan, a co-founder of the Project for New American Century and husband of Victoria Nuland, broke his silence in a March 6th op-ed in the Washington Post entitled, Republicans Are Becoming Russia's Accomplices. He says, quote, it would have been impossible to imagine a year ago that the Republican Party leadership would be effectively serving as enablers of Russia's interference in this country's political system. Yet, says Kagan, astonishingly, that is the role the Republican Party is playing. U.S. intelligence services, he points out, have stated that the Russian government interfered with the 2016 presidential election with the intention of swinging it to one side. Knowing how cautious the intelligence community is in making such judgments, and given the significance of this particular finding, the evidence must be compelling. Yet we haven't seen it. Anyway, at the very least, writes Kagan, any reasonable person would have to conclude that there is enough evidence to warrant a serious, wide-ranging, and open investigation. End quote. Well, Kagan is a man who is careful with his words. And notice, despite the fact that the intelligence agencies have presented the public with no evidence that the Russians interfere with the presidential elections, that sight and scene must be compelling, and thus, quote, any reasonable person would have to conclude that serious, wide-ranging, and open investigation, end quote, is obligatory. Well, I guess I'm not a reasonable person because I see this entire story as pure propaganda designed to push a new Cold War that could very easily become a hot one under President Trump and his coterie of generals, pushed by American liberals and their war hawk buddies, Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham. When considering the veracity of U.S. intelligence, it should be remembered that it was Kagan's PNAC that called for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein as the most pressing U.S. task in its founding document, that it was his fellow neocons, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Michael Ledeen, and Scooter Libby, who produced the fake intelligence proving that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction and justifying the invasion of Iraq, for which, thanks to President Obama and the Democrats, they were never called to account. It was the same Kagan who served as a foreign policy advisor to both John McCain and Hillary Clinton. And it was her promise, Clinton's promise, to stand up to Russia and Putin that led to his early endorsement of her candidacy. Dear listeners, we have a very real problem when one cannot distinguish Michael Moore, Bill Moyers, Tom Friedman, Paul Krugman, or Rachel Maddow from Robert Kagan. Longtime political activist and former congressional candidate in our district, Norman Solomon, when asked to describe one long rant by Maddow, told his colleague David Swanson, quote, Maddow's 25-minute soliloquy was a liberal version of Glenn Beck at the whiteboard. Her plot line was the current Democratic Party line, free associating facts, possible facts, dubious assertions, and pure speculation to arrive at conclusions that were based on little more than her zeal to portray Trump as a tool of the Kremlin. Even when sober, said Norman Solomon, Joe McCarthy never did it better, end quote. We'll be delving into that, this subject, at 20 Minutes Past with Robert Perry. The longest-running international farce, of course, is the so-called peace process or pursuit of the peace process, designed to put an end to the Israel-Palestine conflict. If anything, it has become even more farcical under the Trump administration, characterized by Trump's appointment of his bankruptcy lawyer, an ultra-right-wing supporter of Israel, David Friedman, as an American ambassador to Israel, and his Orthodox Jewish son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as the person who, the president initially bragged, would bring the conflict to a successful end. Friedman's stated views about Jews who criticize Israel are so outrageous, he's compared them with those who collaborated with the Nazis, that his confirmation by the Senate is being opposed by leading Jewish organizations as well as by members of Congress. Friedman and Kushner have been strong supporters of some of the most right-wing Jewish settlements in the West Bank that Washington and the rest of the world consider illegal. One in particular, Beit El, built near the Palestinian city of Ramallah, has long been Friedman's favorite. Friedman, who has a home in Jerusalem, is the head of a charity, Friends of Beit El, one of the many U.S.-based Israel-directed front groups that were designed to funnel money to Israel and Israeli settlements without paying a dime of federal taxes. Friedman has reportedly raised and donated large amounts of money over the years to Beit El, estimated to be in the millions, while Trump's son-in-law Kushner has also sent quite a bit of money to the settlement, as apparently has Trump himself. In December, following the announcement of Friedman's nomination to be ambassador to Israel, Israeli radio reported that several years earlier, Trump sent a check for $10,000 to a dinner for Beit El, at which Friedman was the guest of honor. Yesterday, you may have heard on NPR that Jason Greenblatt, another longtime lawyer for Trump, who has been put in charge of the latest chapter in the farce by Trump, met with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank. A day earlier, Greenblatt met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for talks that reportedly touched on Israeli settlement construction. The State Department called this an orientation trip that was meant to hear from the two sides about returning to peace negotiations, as if anyone familiar with the conflict would take such meetings or even a statement announcing them without rolling one's eyes. NPR's Daniel Estrin reported from Jerusalem that, quote, Trump has asked Netanyahu to curb settlement building. Greenblatt said Trump also wants the Palestinians' economy and quality of life to improve. Trump's envoy, Estrin noted, is also meeting with the Palestinian Authority president amid a series of Palestinian street protests against the Palestinian leadership and its security ties to Israel. Palestinian riot police beat demonstrators and journalists at a weekend protest, he said. Well, that was from NPR, but there is much more to the story than what you will hear there or read in the mainstream media. First, Mahmoud Abbas's term in office as president of the Palestinian Authority expired in 2008 and was extended for 1 year by the Palestine Liberation Organization until the end of 2009, and after that indefinitely, although it is questionable what right the PLO, a largely moribund organization, has to do so. There has been no election since, and hence the position of president of the Palestinian Authority has arguably been left legally vacant for the past 8 years. Abbas is president only in the eyes of the United States, Israel, and countries doing business with Israel, because it is more convenient for Tel Aviv than dealing with the alternative, a genuine Palestinian leadership that would not agree to collaborate with Israel as was spelled out in the Oslo Agreement, which Abbas himself negotiated and signed 23 years ago. The agreement stipulated that the Palestinian Security Forces' sole responsibility was to keep order among the Palestinians under Israeli occupation and to do whatever was necessary to quell opposition to the occupation, and it is faithfully done that. The Oslo Agreement also legitimized Israel's presence in 60% of the West Bank, what is commonly known as Area C, without any commitment on the part of Israel to end settlement construction or grant Palestinian statehood or independence at any time in the future. Signed with Yasser Arafat's approval and without the presence of a lawyer, Oslo represented the greatest betrayal of a people's struggle by its leadership in the post-World War II era, at the very least. Abbas has now been invited by President Trump to the White House, where he can be expected to shower words of praise for our new president worthy of the bootlicker he has come to be, while Palestinian Americans turn their heads away in embarrassment. Yesterday's NPR report spoke of protests against the Palestinian Authority while Trump's representative was paying a visit to Abbas. What actually occurred, according to someone on the scene, was that members of the Palestinian Authority militia, wielding heavy batons and shooting pepper spray and tear gas, attacked Palestinians protesting the murder of a Palestinian activist and the imprisonment of his five friends by Israeli forces and the Israeli court's decision to pursue charges against them for allegedly storing illegal weapons. The victim, Basil Al-Araj, 34, was a prominent Palestinian political philosopher who was killed by Israeli forces March 6th, 5 months after he was released in Palestinian custody, where he had been imprisoned for 6 months and allegedly tortured by Palestinian Authority intelligence. Palestinian Authority forces had arrested Basil and five of his friends in April of 2016, claiming that they had been in possession of weapons with plans to organize attack against Israel, though no official charges had been leveled against them by Israel or the Palestinian Authority. It should not be forgotten that as long as Israel belligerently occupies Palestinian territory under international law, the Oslo Agreement notwithstanding, Israeli soldiers are as legitimate targets of Palestinian resistance as were soldiers of the German Wehrmacht in Nazi-occupied Europe in World War II. That's something you're not likely to hear or said anywhere else. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. One of the great horrors of the Israeli occupation of Palestine is the brutal treatment of children by the Israeli military. This morning we get a vivid look at the abuse of Palestinian children by the Israeli military through the eyes of Ivan Karakashian, who represents Defense for Children International Palestine, an organization which defends children caught up in the Israeli military courts. These are Palestinian children. Israeli children, when arrested, are processed in the Israeli civil court process, never in military courts. Just the opposite is true of Palestinian children. They are only processed in the military courts, and you are about to hear the difference. Here is Ivan Karakashian of Defense for Children International Palestine, speaking to a group from Boston visiting Israel-Palestine through the Grelta Foundation.
So just to start, Defense for Children International Palestine is we have the word international in our name, but we're very much a local Palestinian NGO. We belong to the worldwide movement, Defense for Children International, but each section is autonomous in terms of its funding and programming, and we don't really report to the central office. In that way, we're really more of a franchise than a branch office. And then the majority, we were set up in 1991 by Rifat Qassis, who himself was in prison for about 6 months. And during his prison term, he realized that children in the military courts and the military detention system were being kept with adults, and realized that children weren't receiving any kind of special protections and their special needs weren't being met. So immediately upon his release, he established Defense for Children International Palestine in 1991 as a strictly legal aid organization for children in distress, and specifically children encountering the military court system. And then in the year 2000, we expanded and we started documenting all violations committed by the Israeli side against Palestinians living in the occupied Palestinian territory. And then in the year 2005, we expanded yet again and began representing children in Palestinian courts accused of Palestinian crimes, as well as documenting violations against children by the Palestinian Authority and by the Palestinian groups. And it's at that point that we became a fully fledged children's rights organization. We're currently the only considered local Palestinian children's organization operating. Some of our key funders and donors and people we work with regularly would be Save the Children, UNICEF, the United Nations Development Program. We're also funded by a few European governments like Sweden, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and several church groups and faith-based communities, both in the U.S. and in Europe. So that's DCI. Then really what my talk will focus on is the Israeli military detention system and what's doing, because you're about to go encounter that, all of you, with the exception of Steve. Apologies again. But then it'll move on to some of the recent violence that we've witnessed against Palestinian children. And then if you guys have questions also about some of the violations on the Palestinian side, I'd be more than happy to answer some of those. And I'll explain the difference in our advocacy at some point between working with the Palestinian side versus the Israeli side. But the first thing that I hope you've heard by now is that in the West Bank, there are two legal systems operating. One applies to all Palestinians since 1967 in its military law, and that applies to everyone, adults, children alike. And the other is Israeli civilian law, which applies to the all settlers living in the West Bank. That, to me, didn't come into complete clear view until I realized what it meant in practice. And in practice, what it means is the Israeli army is here to impose military law, whereas it is not there to administer civilian law. So if you had a group of young Jewish settlers clashing with a group of young Palestinians, the Israeli army has the authority to arrest the young Palestinians, but has no authority to arrest the young Jewish settlers because they belong under civilian law, and only the Israeli police should be arresting the Jewish settlers. So essentially what you end up... And then, moreover, some of the crimes that exist under, or offenses that exist under military law don't exist under the civilian legal system. And so a Palestinian could be committing crime while a Jewish settler could be doing the exact same act and not be committing that crime. And so one person would get arrested, the other wouldn't. And those are just, you know, this real discrimination that exists in that system and how it applies to Palestinians. Israel is the only country in the world that systematically prosecutes and convicts somewhere between 500 to 700 children every year in military courts. That's the case that we've been documenting that since at least 2000, that number specifically. And then within within that number, we find that children during arrest in the first 24 to 48 hours experience all kinds of abuse and violations of their rights. And that's when the arrest process begins. So the majority of children are arrested between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. The reason Israeli soldiers arrest, or the reason they say they arrest children between midnight and 5 a.m. is because if they arrested them in the middle of the day, they'll say it'll cause more clashes and be more dangerous to all sides. So it's easier to come in the middle of the night and arrest these children. That is kind of like a false choice, because the other thing that they could do is they could summon children to appear for questioning. And that's something that Defense for Children International Palestine raised and UNICEF through UNICEF to the Israeli authorities, and they began piloting a summons system to ask children to come in for questioning. But they haven't kept up any data about how the summons process was going, and they haven't told anyone where they're applying this pilot program and whether they're still applying it or not. It's unclear to them.
So they're not arresting children who are out on the streets in these hours. They're going to their homes.
What happens is, a lot of the times, if there's a sort of a protest or a clash mm-hmm. taking place, from the military watchtowers, you'll have like soldiers taking photographs of all the people in the area. And then they'll go in later that night to see, you know, they'll have sort of an idea of what the children, their ages, and who lives in each area. And they'll have their ID numbers, and they'll go into the house seeking the same ID number and then comparing it to the photo they took earlier in the day. Oftentimes, they're taking photos not necessarily of children throwing stones or in the act of an offense, but really just any and everyone in the area. So it'd be a lot of children on rooftops watching what's going down on the street, and those guys will get snapped up first. In fact, the rate of rearrest is extremely high, because it's the same children that live next to the same military watchtower that are repeatedly getting their photos taken, repeatedly getting picked up for questioning. So what these children, but with the summons process, just so I could wrap up with that, essentially what Israel did for a while was they would send units of soldiers to their home. They would raid the home in the middle of the night, carry out all the exact same violations, but before leaving at 3 or 4 a.m., leave a piece of paper in Hebrew saying, you know, we're summoning you for questioning the next day at 8 a.m., and then leave. And then once the dad brought the child at 8 a.m. for questioning, he would be immediately separated from his child, and the child would then go through the exact same abuses he was going through afterwards. So while we believe the summons process would help stop a lot of these violations, the way it's being applied is not in good faith by the Israeli authorities. But to just quickly describe the experience of a child being arrested in the middle of the night, usually what happens is you have a unit or two of soldiers raiding the home. You know, we hear sometimes between 14 to 18 soldiers come to the home. They'll raid the home. They'll go in. They'll start destroying furniture as they search the entire house. We've had some children wake up in their bedroom in their pajamas, only to find about 5 soldiers surrounding them, aiming their machine guns and telling them to get up very quickly with them. Of course, when that happens, something very quickly happens to the child psychologically, which is the child realizes that his home isn't a safe place, that his room doesn't offer any kind of privacy or safety. And more importantly, he realizes that his parents are powerless to protect him. When soldiers show up to arrest children, they don't have to show you, they don't have to tell or inform the parents where the child is being taken or why the child has been arrested. They just say, we need to take this child, he's done something wrong, and they take him. So essentially, for a certain period of time, depending on the age of the child disappears in a sense, where the parents don't know exactly where that child's being taken or why he has been taken. If the child is 12 or 13 years old, it's usually about 24 hours. If he's 14 and 15, it's 48 hours that he disappears. And if he's 16 or 17, it's up to 96 hours that they don't really know where he is. Yeah.
How often is this going on with how many kids?
So it's estimated around this year that it'd be around 1,000 kids, 1,200
kids. So 3 times. Three times a day.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And is that happening?
But there's a big difference between children they detain and children they arrest. Mm-hmm. They detain far more children than they arrest children. So during clashes, like you were asking, You know, are these the children? They might detain a lot of children during classes, but they'll let them go within 2 to 3 hours or maybe up to 6 hours. But essentially, they won't charge them with anything. With arrested children, it's the ones that end up being convicted in military courts, and that's where the 500 to 700 number estimate comes in.
And this is happening in the West Bank?
This is specifically in the West Bank.
Israel proper.
It's not in Israel. No, the military...
Doesn't operate there.
Doesn't operate, and the military law doesn't apply to Israeli civilians. And also, even though it applies in the West Bank, it doesn't apply to Jewish settlers living in the West Bank. So it only applies to Palestinians in the West Bank. Yeah, it also doesn't apply to Palestinians living in East Jerusalem because Israel considers the entirety of Jerusalem its undivided capital and therefore applies civilian law to everyone, including East Jerusalemites, who tend to be all Palestinians. But within the civilian legal system and civilian criminal law, there's a lot of discrimination. So even though Palestinians living in East Jerusalem have these protections in theory, when they show up before a judge, they'll face a lot of discrimination the way the judge administers the law to them in East Jerusalem. And so what happens with these children is then they're immediately blindfolded. The Israeli army puts plastic hand ties on their wrists, often so tightly that when our lawyers catch up with these children a few days later, they'll still find the markings of the plastic cord. And then the children are placed on the metal floor of the military jeep. And that's usually when the physical violence begins. Between the years 2012 and 2015, we collected 429 affidavits in equal numbers from children, and about 75% of all those children suffered some form of physical violence at the hand of the arresting officers and throughout the interrogation, that first 24-hour period. What's important is once they've been arrested, they no longer pose a threat. And so to suffer violence after you no longer pose a threat is a particular violation of their rights. We've had children being slapped, kicked, punched. The soldiers will use the butts of their rifles against these children. In some extreme circumstances, we've had soldiers extinguish cigarette butts on the lips and the arms of the children. We've had one case where a soldier had an empty beer bottle that he smashed on the head of one of the children. So abuses vary while you're en route being transferred to a military base. And because these children are being arrested in the middle of the night, the interrogator is typically not ready to interrogate these children because he's sleeping. And so the children will get moved around from military base to military base until it's time for their interrogation period. Throughout that time, children are sort of kept blindfolded, except every time they go from one military base to the next, they are strip searched, they meet a doctor, asks them some very common questions and doesn't even care what they answer. But they strip search the children every time they go through to a military base. And then they'll let them get dressed again, put back the blindfolds, put back the hand ties. They won't bring the children any food or water or access to toilets. And if the child asks for any of those three things, you could expect more abuse. And in the military bases, we've also recorded several instances where they'll let children into a small room with the military dogs. And they know Palestinian children are specifically scared of these dogs. And just anything to sort of frighten the child. By the time the child shows up to interrogation, he's gone through something like 12 hours where the trauma started at home. He was beaten up on the way to the military bases. His parents have no idea where he was taken or why he was taken. He's feeling completely alone. It's been 12 hours of this abuse, and then he's brought into an interrogation room with a very professional interrogator wanting to get a confession out of that child. If the child doesn't immediately confess, and then children in the military, under military law, have really two rights only, the right to remain silent and the right to consult an attorney prior to the interrogation. They're under military law not allowed to have the attorney present during the interrogation or to have a parent present during the interrogation.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Yeah. They can consult an attorney before prior. Interrogation, but yeah. not during.
But they can't have the attorney sitting with them during the interrogation.
Okay.
Yeah. And then in fact, in 97% of cases, they're denied consulting with an attorney prior to interrogation. So even though they have that right, it's denied to them in about 97% of cases that we documented from those 429 affidavits. Moreover, the children, even though they're sort of, we used to say that children aren't informed of their rights at all. So now there's a piece of paper that they present the children with Arabic and Hebrew stating those two rights, and they force the children to sign this piece of paper. But often the children don't have the time to read, and even if they read, the interrogators don't ask the children whether they've properly understood their rights. And they're just asked to sign it, and the paper's taken away. That way, when we come and say they're not informed of their rights, they can present that piece of paper and say, look, he signed it, you must know his rights. So now we say that children aren't properly informed of their rights to a level where they understand them and can apply them. During the interrogation, if the child doesn't cooperate with the interrogator, then you'll expect, you know, the old phone book, or the interrogator will bring in a baton and hit the child with it. And you'll get all kinds of physical violence, shaking, slapping on the ears to disorient the child. Throughout the interrogation, the child is handcuffed and shackled to a small metal chair in an uncomfortable position. So there's quite a lot of position abuse and rising the use of position abuse while interrogating these children. And then if the child still doesn't cooperate after that level of physical violence is applied, then they'll start using psychological violence, and specifically the use of solitary confinement against children. Here, solitary confinement is used in a way that's very different than the way it's used in the U.S. In the U.S., if solitary confinement is being used against a child, it's usually after the child has been convicted of a crime. And if he steps out of line while serving a sentence, they might use solitary confinement as a punishment. Oftentimes you'll hear the argument in the U.S. that it's to protect the child, and so they want to separate him from a particularly hostile group of people, or they don't have the facilities to separate him from adults, so they'll place him in solitary confinement. In the Israeli context, a child is placed into solitary confinement before he's been even charged with a crime. And they'll put a child into solitary confinement until the child is ready to confess to wrongdoing, so that they could then charge the child with that wrongdoing. We've had this year a rise in the number of solitary confinement cases. There are about 17% of children are put through solitary confinement. This was for this year's statistics. That translates to, out of the 158 cases we document, well over, I think, 25 or 26 were placed into solitary confinement this year from the cases that we documented. The longest period that a child spent in solitary confinement this year was 29 days. So 29 days in a cell that's about the size of one and a half of these tables. So it's a very small cell.
Yeah.
From here to here, yeah. And it has no windows. There's a small open slit at the top of one of the walls that lets in cold air. And in the summer, it doesn't let in enough cold air, and in the winter, it lets in too much cold air. Yeah.
A child that would be kept in solitary for that length of time, would that be someone, you know, 16, 17?
The majority are 16 and 17. We've had a few 15-year-olds also.
But not the older kids who were pulled in.
No, it'd be seldom that a 14 or 13-year-old would be put in.
So 15 and over, probably.
15 and over, yeah. I would say the vast majority, yeah. And then there's a yellow dim light that's kept on 24 hours so that the child doesn't know what time of day it is. There's a small, thin mattress for the child to stay on. And because there are protrusions coming out of the wall, it makes it difficult for the child to lean up against any of the walls. So he has to stay in the center of the room. And the only human contact he has is when he's brought out intermittently for interrogation, or when the flap in the door is opened and his food tray is brought in. And so And then, you know, we even had as one 17-year-old last year spent about 45 days in that condition. And according to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, if an adult spends any time longer than 2 days, it's tantamount to torture. So if you can imagine someone under the age of 18 spending 45 days, 29 days, and at that point, the child hasn't done anything wrong. They haven't charged the child. You know, he's presumed innocent and yet thrown into solitary confinement.
Or they, when they're in solitary, they're no longer blindfolded or wristbound, right?
No, they're no longer blindfolded or wristbound.
Why would they hold somebody in solitary for so long if there's no charges? Wouldn't that be a waste of resources, or is there some other...
It's to force the child to confess.
To something, even if they haven't been charged for X number of days, like 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah, they have the ability to not charge the child for up to, I think, 55 days. And so they could keep you there under suspicion, but you have to appear before a military court judge to get sort of reviewed. And so sometimes if they've put you in solitary confinement, the interrogator will appear before a military court judge, explain the extenuating circumstances, and ask for more time in interrogating the child.
It sounds like a false confession. Why would they want a false confession?
It is a false confession. That's the point that I'm getting to. A lot of these confessions are what we would consider coerced confessions that should be immediately thrown out from the courts. Even the cases that don't involve solitary confinement but involve physical violence during the interrogations or other types of duress should immediately be thrown out. But
why would they want that, though?
Because the military judges accept it. They never question these. They don't throw out these forced confessions.
Why would they want a conviction based on a forced confession?
That's a good question. Yeah. So just to let you know, the military court system has a 99% conviction rate.
Yeah.
And so they convict everyone. Why are they convicting these children specifically? And why are they arresting through convicting these children, putting them through the military court system? We believe it's, you know, when you hear courts, you think courts administer justice. But we believe that in this case, the military courts administer control over a population.
So that's the ultimate
goal. And that's the ultimate goal. If you have children, which is the most vulnerable demographic of Palestinian society, and you put them through these horrific conditions of the military court system, then you ensure that the rest of the population stays in control.
So they want control over them, and this is a...
They want to put fear...
Because ultimately they want to...
That's how they sustain the overall occupation. You know, it's also similar to some of the... You guys went to Hebron already?
Yes.
Yeah, so in Hebron, I went on a few speaking tours with Breaking the Silence, which is a group of former Israeli soldiers that have decided to talk about what their experiences have gone through. And one thing that one of those soldiers mentioned while I was speaking to him was that there are small units of soldiers controlling a population in the hundreds of thousands in Hebron. So how do you get, you know, 20, 30, 40 soldiers managing to control a population of several hundred thousand?
And that control is all ultimately about possession of the land.
Possession of the land, but how do you get Palestinians wholesale not to protest and go out in the streets and then kill all 40 soldiers, because 100,000 people could effectively manage to overtake 40 soldiers?
That's what they said in Nabi Salah, that they stopped the demonstrations because all of the kids between 10 and 15 or whatever had all been arrested. Basically.
Yeah. But even if you arrest them and release them, what you're doing is that entire system of control that you're putting over that population enables a handful of soldiers to control a large population. It's through intimidation, through, you know, occasionally beating up a random Palestinian for no reason, and through the arrest process, which they use. They use any kind of tactic to show and establish the strength of their presence in an area. And the military court system is part and parcel of that attitude of establishing strength, possession, and occupation over an area.
I just want to ask, Ivan, the solitary confinement, the physical abuse, I'm assuming that that's also intended not only to gain a confession, but also to gain information, intelligence information from the child as to who else in the village is causing problems, or am I mistaken on that?
Most children do confess against other children as well. What our lawyers end up with, and when they receive a file for a client, is the confession of that child, the confession of the other children that were with that child, but all of which
the
were all
the confession, but the accusation, the finger.
Yeah, like let's say five children went out throwing stones. Mm-hmm. So I'll get each of the four to say that the fifth one also threw a stone.
Sure.
And they'll go around. But actually, what we found that there are a few cases where they try to put a lot of pressure on the child to become an ongoing informant. And those cases are more anecdotal. Obviously, it's difficult to get a child to say, yes, I'm now an informant for the Israeli authorities on the record. We know that it does take place, that a lot of that pressure is applied to try and turn some of these children into informants. But the majority of the cases are not that. The majority of the cases are getting children to confess against other children in a very particular incident, but not to become ongoing informants. And then the third thing that our lawyers get is the statement of the arresting military officer. And because it's a military system, they never question the statement of the military officer. So if the military officer will just say, I'm arresting you because I think I saw you throwing stones, that's perfect. You know. And if the child then says, yes, I threw stones, and they get two other children that say, that child threw stones, that's the entirety of the case.
Innocent until suspected.
And then what happens is our lawyers receive this file with these three or four documents, and then they realize you can't really practice law with that. You know, they're not allowed to really present evidence or call for evidence. And so what ends up happening is the majority of the cases end up in plea deals between the lawyer and the Israeli military prosecutor. And so it's important for our lawyers, for DCI's lawyers, to maintain good relationships with the military prosecutors in order to get the best deals for these children. And then part of why we say it's a system of control is if a child decides I'm innocent and I don't want to plead guilty for a plea deal, the majority of children are denied bail. About 87% of children are denied bail during their court proceedings. And court proceedings for an offense can take up to a year or longer. And if you're denied bail, you're in prison for that year or longer period. And with a 99% conviction rate, you'd end up essentially spending a year or longer in prison only to get a guilty verdict in the end anyway. Whereas if children do plea deals, we found that most children receive a plea deal between 3 to 12 months. Which is actually shorter. It's shorter and a faster way out of the military system if you plead guilty, whether you've done something or not, than if you plead innocent and then get denied bail and spend all that time in jail waiting for a court verdict.
So the average length of stay is between 3 and 12 months
for children who plea.
How much does it cost to incarcerate somebody, you know, a child, for that period of time? Because there's going to be a costs associated with it to Israel, and how many children are locked up for that period?
So the majority, so about like 53% of children that we documented out of the 429 affidavits are the ones that spent between 3 to 12 months. You have the remaining percentages are children who spend under 3 months or children who end up spending well over 12 months. The prison system and how you pay for that stuff is actually very, very interesting. It's actually a bit of an industry where the Israeli system ends up making money out of these children. Out of the canteens that the Israeli system operates within the prison, so let's say you wanted an extra bed sheet, or you wanted toothpaste, or you wanted a toothbrush, or an additional pajama, you'd have to purchase that from the canteen. And I think it's estimated that the canteen makes the Israeli system about 18 million shekels a month.
But how much does it cost to actually incarcerate these kids per month? Because I used to work in jail and prison. That was
yeah.
And there's no way we could have ever, even with our mass prison, you know, over like our mass incarceration in the US, we could never pay for the costs of incarceration and make money on it through the canteen purchases. And that's not even just because people are poor, but it's just the costs of the salaries, the infrastructure, the food.
There's no, that's the thing. There's very little infrastructure, very little provided for these, for children specifically here. Yeah. Very little is provided by the Israeli prison service in terms of provisions for these children. So, and I'll compare here with Israeli prisons.
Well, most of those costs would be the salaries anyway.
But there are no salaries, that's the thing. So what they've done is...
No, wait, one sec.
Yeah. So what they've done is the Palestinian National Prisoners Committee agreed with the Israeli prison services that several of their adult members would take care of these children and look after these children so that these children don't have direct contact with the Israeli prison guards and therefore wouldn't face abuse by the Israeli prison guards. It's effectively what the National Prisoners Committee ended up doing is they found five Palestinian adult prisoners serving long-term sentences and made them surrogate parents for these children. They live in the same juvenile section as the children, but they're kept in a separate cell.
Did you say these are other people who are criminally convicted?
Who are convicted of so-called security offenses. Okay, so we differentiate between security and criminal.
Okay.
So they're not murderers and rapists, right, okay, but they've done security offenses against Israel.
Which could be something as a false charge or a false confession.
Potentially, but except, you know, some of these are serving the law. You know, they don't want to keep on switching out these five prisoners. Mm-hmm. So the ones that they've selected are ones serving 10 or more years of sentence. So typically their charges tend to be
something real
or higher. Yeah. But basically they're nominated by the National Palestinian Prisoners Committee.
So these guys are overlooking all the
kids. About 70 to 75 kids in Meshuggah prison.
So it's 1 to 75 ratio.
No, it's 5 to 75.
5 to 75, okay. 5 to 75. So who's overlooking those five people?
So then you have a few prison guards, okay. Israeli prison guards, that oversee. So, and then what happens is if the child needs something, he'll tell the surrogate parent, which is that Palestinian prisoner, and then the Palestinian prisoner will tell the head of the National Palestinian Committee based in that prison, who will then have official talks with the warden of that prison.
What is the name, please, again, of the prison?
Meshuggah, M-E-G-I-D-D-O
prison. Okay.
So if there were a serious situation with a child, there's not immediate treatment because it's got to go through all of these levels before anyone even...
No, but like if the child was severely sick, for example, then one of the adult Palestinians will tell the medical staff immediately and will accompany that child.
Okay, so it doesn't have to go through all those...
No, this is more like the children want, like they have a big demand and it's important. And then,
okay.
And so the way the National Palestinian Prisoners Committee won the right to get these five adults to take care of these children is they went on hunger strike and it was through long negotiations. And so since 2009, these five individuals have been taking care of these children. And then the prison authorities don't provide the food for the children. In fact, a lot of the food, but I need to double check this, a lot of the food is actually sent in by the Palestinian Authority, and it's sent in uncooked form, so it's, you know, raw chickens and whatever, and it's kept in a freezer, and then the children end up cooking their own meals under the supervision of the five adult prisoners. So the five adult prisoners are actually... take care of the children generally, but each has a role, and one of them takes on the role of overseeing, teaching these children how to cook their own meals.
What about healthcare? These kids, I mean...
They receive healthcare, but they're not denied healthcare. They receive decent healthcare if something is wrong with them.
Who pays for it?
Who
pays for it?
Again, no, that would be the Israel Prison Service.
Israel Prison Service does, okay.
So Megiddo would be within Israel. That's an Israel.
Megiddo would be within
and
Israel.
That's the Hebrew name for Armageddon, as I recall. It's a, you don't know. I think it is. And The fact that these children are taken out of the occupied territories...
That's in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And that actually has practical consequences as well, because it means that when their parents go to visit, they need to get a permit, and they need to coordinate with the Red Cross. But a lot of parents struggle to get a permit, and it takes them about two months or longer to get a permit. And sometimes by the time they get that permit, their child is ready to be released anyway. And so they won't visit that child throughout this period of incarceration because of difficulty to get access. Things that exist in an Israeli prison for Israeli children that doesn't exist for Palestinian children. Israeli children have access to counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, a lot of educators, and a lot of just general care around them. Also, Israeli children, for example, are taken out on field visits. They get to, sometimes they're released during the holiday periods back to their parents. None of this stuff exists for Palestinian children. Also, Israeli children are taught in keeping with the Israeli curriculum so that upon their release, they could immediately reintegrate back into the school system. A child once took the matriculation exam at an Israeli prison that had a lot of mental health issues. The one thing that kept him calm was having a parrot on his shoulder. So they allowed him to take the exam with a parrot on his shoulder. There's a petting zoo for these. So operating a prison for Israeli children is extremely expensive. Yeah, none of this stuff is provided for Palestinian children. Palestinian children are provided with an education, in quotes, but really the only approved subjects are math, Arabic, and Hebrew. And they're taught at an elementary level, and the way the children are divided is based on their level of assessed intelligence. And so what you end up having is you have an extremely intelligent 17-year-old with an extremely intelligent 13-year-old taking the same math class.
When you put those types of kids together, like at that type, different age range, you're going to have, in the United States anyway, the potential for a lot of bullying, and that creates a whole other series of traumas. Does that go on here, or is there a little bit more empathy among the kids because they're all in a sort of shared experience?
There's a little bit of empathy among the kids, but also there's quite a lot of respect of the five adult prisoners, and they keep everyone in line. And if someone steps out of line, which does actually happen occasionally, they'll, for example, deny him TV privileges. Right, exactly. They'll find a way to punish ground that child. Yeah, but in general, we hear of very little actual bullying taking place.
With there being probably little bullying, you probably also don't hear about like sexual assaults on kids or anything.
In
the U.S., in this sort of situation, if the system was set up like this in the U.S., I would guarantee it would happen. I would put my job on it. I don't mean that in a good way. I mean it would be a really unfortunate consequence.
But no, and again, I think the main difference here is a lot of these is the differentiation between a security offense and a criminal offense.
Yeah.
I think there was a couple of Jerusalem children that were placed, that were sort of convicted on a security offense, but placed with other young Israeli offenders. Some of them were like rapists, murderers, and that kid went through quite a lot of abuse.
In the U.S., the bullying happens in schools. And you're from the U.S., right? Or you're
no, I'm not.
No,
from
but you just did law school in the U.S.
I did journalism school in the U.S.
Oh, journalism school. Okay, so. But yeah, but you know how it is, though. Even in a regular school, the kids experience, the bullying and harassment. So that's great that they don't deal with that under this. I mean, that's just people.
I mean, there is some,
but it's just nice that there's just one less thing that they're subjected to. I was concerned
and
about it's, that.
And that's actually a testament to how well, because whenever I tell people that there are five adult male prisoners taking care of these children, people tend to freak out and they're like,
But it seems like they've developed a community where they're really supporting
each other. Yeah, and every child that I've spoken to after having gone through and lived with these five, what they call surrogate parents, they've all had high praise for the five and said they wouldn't have survived their prison experience without these five.
That's great.
Are females ever...
arrested.
Yeah.
Yeah. Female girls under 18. Yeah, yeah. But it's at a far less number than Palestinian boys. So, you know, in February, which was the highest number we recorded ever of Palestinian children in prison, since the Israeli prison service started providing that data, we had about 440 children in Israeli custody that month, of which 15 were girls.
And
so,
they're obviously kept someplace else.
Yeah.
And do they have the same surrogate parent situations?
I think because there's so few of them that it hasn't been sort of worked out. Because in the past, up until February of this year, the previous year, there was one girl.
Oh.
And she was, I think, 17. And usually with girls, it's a bit of a different situation. Most girls get arrested in the past, not the 15 once the final situation escalated here. But in the past, a lot of girls get arrested because they're actually wanting to get arrested to escape some sort of social issue. So forced early marriage or sexual abuse at home, and they don't know how to escape it. They'll walk up with a knife or something at a checkpoint to get arrested to be taken out of that
situation. They're lucky if they're just arrested.
Well, yeah, they're lucky if they're... And actually, with girls, it's rare that you hear girls getting shot or... The attitude towards boys is far more violent than the attitude towards girls. And this is at least before February of last year. February of last year, no, there were a lot more girls involved and arrested, but a lot more within...
And would those girls also be in prison in Israel?
In Israel, yeah, but in a different prison, in
right.
Hasharon, yeah.
So there are no prisons in the occupied territories? Any prisoners taken...
No, there are prisons in the... So Ofer, where you guys are going, is both a military court
and
a prison.
Okay.
But technically, once a child is convicted of his crime and is given a final sentence, he's moved out of Ofer. Ofer is only meant to be a temporary holding facility. But because it's easier for children to see their families at Ofer and to attend their court sessions at Ofer, often what they'll do is they'll delay their sentencing until they've spent about 3 months in Ofer, and then they know that in their plea deal they're about to get 3 months, and so their transfer inside Israel will only be for that final week, and that ensures they could have access to their parents while at Ofer and access to the courts and not have to be transferred between Megiddo and Ofer.
And the Israeli military is
sort of goes along with it. Yeah, it goes along with it. But now, if a child is going to serve much longer than 3 months, no, they end up getting shipped to Megiddo. Yeah.
So the third educational subject for Palestinian
Arabic, Hebrew, math,
Hebrew.
Yeah,
Hebrew is one of them. And that's
but it's not, Hebrew's not offered at all the prisons. So Hebrew's offered at Ofer, I believe, but not at Megiddo.
And
none of it, by the way, is in keeping with the Palestinian curriculum. So it's not like, so even though you're limited, yeah, once you, and actually that's problematic because even though children are serving like 3 months and you think, oh, 3 months, it's not the end of the world. The child will get through it somehow. It'll be fine. It won't be fine in the sense that when they fall behind, the Palestinian Ministry of Education has a rule that if an imprisoned child misses more than 60 consecutive days of schooling and they can't keep up with their studies, they would have to repeat the school year.
Right. So it's a double whammy.
Yeah, but I mean, it makes sense because how else can you progress that child forward? The problem is a lot of these children, and something I didn't state at the outset, is come from the most vulnerable families, the most impoverished people we would be worried about as street kids. But instead, here they are contending with the Israeli occupation first. But that means when they're released, their parents can't afford private tutoring or support them to catch up with their classes.
You're basically taking an at-risk kid and making them worse off.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And also because of that, because of the experience that children go through, the fact that they're completely cut off from their family throughout their period of the majority of them are cut off for significant periods of their incarceration, it means that the child quickly feels he's become an adult and leaves his childhood behind. And when you want to hold back a child, that now feels he's become an adult, he's gone through some sort of rite of passage. They don't want that. They're like, what am I going to be doing with these little kids? You know, I'm now an adult. So a lot of them end up dropping out, getting some sort of vocational training and joining the labor force, where they're open to a lot of exploitation. So, you know, what we realize is those 3 months, 4 months changes the entire trajectory of that kid's life.
You have been listening to a presentation by Ivan Karakashian of the Defense for Children International Palestine. And that wraps it up for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Just click on Listen on the homepage. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, those of our families, our debts, and these kinds of issues looked at in a way that the mainstream media often ignores or bypasses. You're going to hear here other ways of understanding what's going on, in order to make the flow of economic events clearer and more manageable for all of us. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life, trying as hard as I know how to make all of this clear and understandable and manageable. Today I work at the New School University here in New York City, but I've taught at other schools as well. And I try to bring that history of teaching to this program. I also want, before I jump into the economic updates for this week, to say how proud I am to welcome to this audience the viewers who come to us through the Free Speech television network and programming. Free Speech TV is now a partner with our Democracy at Work project. Very important to us, very valuable to us. We are proud to be able to reach more of you and to engage with you in a discussion about what's happening to us economically speaking. So welcome especially those of you who come to us through the Free Speech TV system. And if you're interested, we are on Free Speech TV Sunday evenings, 7 o'clock Eastern Time, and the corresponding adjustments for Central Mountain and Pacific times. 7 p.m. Sunday in the evening for the next 3 weeks, and then back to a normal time of 8 o'clock. But it's 7 o'clock now on Sundays. Okay. This last week has been characterized by a great deal of information, hoopla, and press coverage of the activities of the Federal Reserve System, whose committee in charge of these things is deciding or has decided about interest rates. And much has been said about that. I don't want to repeat all of that, but I want to give some perspective on the Federal Reserve raising and lowering interest rates, which it has done periodically for many, many, many years. I want to remind everyone what the point and purpose of the Federal Reserve raising and lowering interest rates always was. And the purpose has been to manage the capitalist economic system of the United States, and in a particular way, with a particular goal. The problem of our capitalist system, one of its major problems, is that it is highly unstable. Every 4 to 7 years, it has a downturn that can last, well, this one has lasted since 2008, if you look at it seriously. The great one in 1929 lasted 11 years, and they typically can last anywhere from a few months to as long as I just mentioned. And then capitalism can sometimes zoom too far the other way and have a crazy inflation where prices go nuts, as we saw in the 1970s, and so on. The system is unstable. Between the end of the crash of 1929 that lasted throughout the 30s and the beginning of the second worst crash of capitalism, the one that hit us in 2008 and 9, there were 11 other economic downturns. In other words, capitalism is unstable. The Federal Reserve was supposed to stop all of that, to overcome all of that, to prevent this instability. And the idea was simple. When the economy goes down, lower interest rates. Why? Because then it's cheaper to borrow. And if people have an easier time borrowing money for a business or for their own consumption, they'll spend more and that'll offset the economy's tendency to go down. And likewise, if the economy is in an inflation, raise the interest rates, because then people will have a harder time to borrow and then be less likely to do so and less likely to spend. You get the picture. Manipulate the interest rates, give that job to the Fed, and we won't have the ups and downs of our capitalist system. Why am I telling you this? The Fed has been doing what it was supposed to do, raising and lowering interest rates, just as it has been doing right through this week. Has it solved the problem? Has it succeeded in preventing this system from being unstable? And the only answer to that question is no, it hasn't. It has failed at the task set for it. It hasn't overcome the instability. The only defense that you can really make for the Federal Reserve is the usual defense made by people who fail when they do something like this. And that argument goes like this. It would have been even worse if we hadn't done what we did. And you know something? That may be true. It's one of those statements that can always maybe be true. But it's a very limp response when the reality is the instability of our system remains and the Federal Reserve has not overcome it. I want to also mention that in this last week, the Trump administration named two more high leaders of its economic team. The first is James Donovan, who was nominated to become the Secretary of the Treasury, a very high official that must be ratified by the U.S. Senate. And the second one, I don't think needs to be ratified by the Senate, J. Christopher Giancarlo, who's going to be head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. That may sound arcane, but that's the body of the government that oversees the derivatives market, a market of many, many trillions of dollars, which was a major cause of the collapse of 2008. That's an important market to be the commissioner of. Why am I mentioning these two men? Because they both come from an interesting place, Goldman Sachs banks. They represent even more of an influence of the Goldman Sachs Corporation on Mr. Trump than was already the case, even more than the influence of Goldman Sachs on the Obama administration, which was considerable also. But in light of the campaign, it's really hard not to mention these things, and I leave you to draw your own conclusions as to Mr. Trump's hostility, we are supposed to believe, to the banking leaders of this country for their role in what has happened. As if to underscore this point, let me turn quickly to the third short update of this program, and to remind particularly some of you, and to welcome the new ones watching today's program. In the first half of the program, I usually have these short updates. And then in the second half, I have either an interview, as we're going to have today, with a guest on a particular topic, and today it will be the housing crisis of the United States, or I offer a more extended discussion of one or two major topics. So the first half is short updates, and the second half a more developed kind of analysis of a major issue of concern. And let me also point out that the way we choose the topics, both for these short updates and for the longer discussions, is based particularly on what we hear from you. We maintain two websites. The first is rdwolf with two Fs.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites allow you to communicate directly to us, to be a kind of partner with us. Let us know what you would like us to talk with you about, what you would like us to analyze, what questions to answer, and so on. Both of those websites allow you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, if you wish. Both of those websites provide you with a wealth of information, video, audio, written materials that go far beyond what we have the time to do on this program. So if you're at all interested, make use of these websites. They're available 24/7 at your convenience, and there's absolutely no charge for either of them for anything that they provide to you. They are a service. They're part of why we make this program and why we have this project. So once again, democracyatwork.info and rdwolf.com. Okay, the next update kind of follows from the earlier ones. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, one of the most important sources of economic analysis and statistics in the federal government, that every economist I know uses all the time. The Bureau of Labor Statistics issued its regular report on March 15th, the middle of this last week, on what has happened to hourly wages in the United States. People who earn income by virtue of getting an hourly wage, which is the vast majority of American workers. Over the last year, February 2016 through February 2017, so we're right up to date, literally a couple weeks ago, there was a 0.0 change in people's real hourly wage. Here's what that means. The prices went up over the last year exactly as much as people's wages per hour went up. In other words, you couldn't buy any more with your wages in February 2017 than you could buy with your wages on average in a year ago. Absolutely no increase in the wage you get in terms of what it can allow you to buy. Unfortunately for American workers, over the same period, the last year, the average work week in this country fell by 0.3%. In other words, the length of time the average worker could work fell. Well, when you put together that the amount you got per hour of work didn't change, but the number of hours you were able to work fell, you get the following result. The real weekly wage of American workers on average not only didn't go up over the last year, it fell by 0.3%. That's a disaster in an economy like ours. It becomes immoral when you look at the enormous wealth accumulated by the top 1%, including over the last year. And it raises a profound question that people looking at the so-called Trump effect, or the bounce to the American economy supposedly accomplished by the election back in early November, now some months ago, of Donald Trump, well, whatever the bounce is, it may be happening to the stock market, and it may be happening to corporate profits, and it may make Wall Street ecstatic. But for the average American worker, nothing. Not even the same. Shrinkage is the story that comes out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics this last week. Let's move right along, because we have quite a few to cover. My next economic update has to do with the Ford Motor Company and the General Motors Company. I don't have to explain to you what these companies are. They're icons of American manufacturing. And both of them this last week made announcements. Well, let's put it more accurately. The Ford company made announcements, and in its announcements, it compared itself to General Motors in a way I think you'll find useful. Let's start with what I found to be the most stunning statistic. In 2016, for the first time in history, the General Motors Corporation, this is in January of this year. It's very hot off the press here. January of 2017, for the first time in history, the General Motors Corporation sold more Cadillacs in China than it sold in the United States. I want to let that sink in. Why? Because it turns out, in part, that last year, 2016, General Motors built a factory in Shanghai to produce 160,000, you guessed it, Cadillacs a year for the Chinese market. This has the Ford Motor Company, a competitor, upset. Cadillac is muscling in on the enormous market of wealthy people in China with the money and the desire to buy fancy cars. And now interested in American fancy cars. Before, they were buying Mercedes and things like that. Now they're buying Cadillacs. So the Ford Motor Company announced this last week with great pride. It is about to build a factory in China to produce the Lincoln Continental in China for the Chinese market. The quote from the head of Ford, the chief executive there, Mark Fields, goes like this, quote, "Ford's philosophy around the world is to build where we sell." Funny, it wasn't that long ago that Ford was telling President Trump that it wasn't going to produce in Mexico and come back to the United States. How exactly you square that with the philosophy that we build where we sell, if you're selling in China, well, it turns out we shouldn't pay too close attention, should we? American companies are building in China because that's what they have to do to make money. And in the contest between Mr. Trump's promises and what these companies' profits require, if you're expecting Mr. Trump's promises to prevail, I think you're in for a disappointment. Next item. I want to talk a little bit about China and the United States, since it follows so nicely from what we just discussed. Interesting statistics came out this last week from a group of people that do wonderful research. They're called the Wealth and Income Database .world, W-I-D .world. It's a group of economists, the famous ones Thomas Piketty in France and Emmanuel Saez at the University of California in Berkeley. They have a group that keeps the best statistics on global inequality that we really have. They have a free website where you can go and take advantage of these statistics if they are interesting to you. Here I'm just going to summarize some remarkable statistics about the United States and China, arguably the two most important economic players in the world today. The first statistic of interest is the level of inequality. Is China unequal? And the answer is absolutely yes. And I'm going to give you one. There are many statistics that show it, but just one because I find it clear and dramatic. The top 1% of the Chinese people together own 13% of the country's wealth. The highest 1% own 13% of the wealth. Let me compare that to the bottom half of the Chinese people. We're talking in excess of 600-700 million people. China is the most populous country on this planet. The bottom half of the Chinese people together own 15%. So how dramatic is that? Well, think for a minute. The top 1% has only a little less wealth than the bottom half of the people. That's an unequal distribution of wealth. But it is nothing compared with the inequality of the United States. Same group of economists using the same methodology. Here's their result for the United States. The top 1% in this country, the United States, owns 20% of the wealth. In China, the top 1% owns 13%. In this country, the top 1% owns 20% of the wealth. And how much of the wealth of America is owned by the bottom 50%? A mere 12%. These are stark numbers. In both the United States and China, over the last 40 years, inequality has grown. Both China and the United States have seen inequality grow. But here is perhaps the most important statistics of all. Over those last 40 years, when inequality grew in China and the United States, it grew in a very different way. In China, the bottom half of the people appreciated, that is, they grew their income by 400% over those 40 years. 400%. Went up five times, in short. An enormous increase in the standard of living of the bottom half of the people. But inequality still grew. And why? Because the top 1%, they zoomed much faster than the bottom half, which is why the inequality got worse. But the inequality could get worse in China, and the mass of people could not complain much about it, could not disrupt the society in dramatic ways in anger about this inequality, because in a way they were quieted by the fact that, yeah, the rich were getting richer, but their standard of living was rising, and quite a bit. This was the situation of the United States until the 1970s. And one of the reasons the United States was able to become the powerhouse capitalist economy it is, or at least it was, is because, yeah, it was becoming more unequal over those years most of the time, but it was raising the standard of living of the mass of people enough that it kept the system okay in the minds of most of the people living in it. The United States used to have what the Chinese now have. Yes, growing inequality, but on the basis of a rising standard of living for the bottom half. But that's where the Chinese and the United States are now so different. because in the last 40 years, the bottom half of the United States has exactly stagnated. It has achieved no increase in its standard of living. Let me drive this home. Over the last 40 years, standard of living of the bottom half of the Chinese people up 400%. Over the last 40 years in the United States, standard of living of the bottom half of the people, nowhere. Doesn't change appreciably at all. That's why the inequality is such an issue in the United States. It is not because it's worse than other countries, even though it is. It's because it is an inequality based on the stagnation of the majority of American people's standard of living. They're watching the rich get further and further away from them. They feel correctly that they're left behind. When the famous author Arlie Hochschild was on this program a few months ago with her new book about those folks in Louisiana and how they felt left behind and got involved in the Tea Party and so on, those people who felt left behind were living and feeling what the Bureau of Labor Statistics and this group of economists, the WID.World, have now proven. They were left behind. They are part of that American majority that watches a growing inequality without the offset of a rising standard of living. Where that will go and how far that will go is anybody's guess. But it bespeaks a dangerous economic situation, particularly for the United States. This level of inequality, based on the stagnation of the standard of living of the mass of people, is a recipe for social conflict one cannot overestimate. In their upset and anger about this situation, the British working class, the majority of British people, is quite like the United States. The statistics there are quite similar. In the anger of the growing inequality based on no rise in the standard of living, or even a fall in the case of England, over the last 30 to 40 years, the British voters surprised the world by their Brexit, by their decision to disengage from the European community and go it on their own, a project that will hurt the British working class, especially as long as they permit the management of this disengagement to be in the hands of the Conservatives, who, after all, are mostly responsible for what has happened to the British working class. And likewise here in the United States, the decision, the surprise of an angry working mass of people to make Mr. Trump the president puts an enormous burden on him. Is he really going to be able or willing, alone or with the people he's gathered around him, such as those Goldman Sachs bankers, to be able to reverse the last 30 to 40 years of history, to really undo them in a way adequate to what agitates the American people? Let's put it this way. If he doesn't, he's going to be in for a hard time, and so is everyone else. Well, we've come to the end of the first half of today's program. The short updates. In a very few moments, we'll shift over. Please stay with us for the second half of this program, because there you will encounter an interview about the housing crisis in the United States, why the housing costs so much, what it means to the American economy, what alternatives there might be to get us out of this crisis that seems to be yet another part of our lives where the pinch is on, where the good times seem to be left behind, as so many Americans feel these days. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of this week's Economic Update. Once again, I'm your host, Richard Wolff. And in the second half of this program, we're going to have an interview. And my guest for this interview is a specialist in the housing crisis that besets the United States economy. So first, let me introduce him to you. His name is Walter South. He's here in the studio with me. Walter has been educated at a number of universities. I won't give you the long list. He has taught at a number of universities, including the City University of New York, the Rutgers University Law School, New York University. He holds a variety of degrees. But why I have him here is not all of that, impressive as it is, but because he has spent the last 50 years of his life working on housing, organizing, managing, literally building housing in the United States, roughly a total of 1,000 units, that's quite a bit, and knows more about housing than anyone I've met in a long time. So since we have a crisis that everybody is talking about, I wanted to bring him here and have a conversation with him about that crisis, what it means, and what can be done about it. So first, welcome, Walter. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
All right. Start off by giving us a thumbnail idea of what this crisis is. Why do we call it a crisis? What's the problem that besets housing in the United States that you would put at the top of your list?
The basic problem is the lack of affordability. The housing has increased in the cost of housing has increased beyond what the average person can pay. And used to be that we thought that if you spent 25% of your income for housing, that was perfectly fine. But
that would make it affordable?
Yeah, theoretically. But what happened, and this 25% came out of something called the Brook Amendment. Senator Brook passed an amendment to the housing policy of asking people in public housing to pay 25% of their income for rent.
In other words, the government thought at that time that that would make an apartment affordable in its own units, so 25% became a standard.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But a few years later, the Congress raised it to 30.
Okay.
So right now, generally speaking, if you're paying more than 30% of your income for housing, you're rent burdened.
You're rent burdened. In other words, You're living in a housing where you're paying more than you really can afford and more than was understood to be reasonable to ask of you.
Right.
Okay.
But unfortunately, when they talk about the rent burden, they don't include a few things like transportation. So if you add transportation to the cost of what you're paying for rent, then it goes much higher than 30%.
Well, I know from many cities I've lived in and other people have lived in that the less money you can afford to pay for your housing, the further you usually have to go from where your job is likely to be in order to find the housing. And so the joke is you make a decision whether or not to rent a place based not just on the rent of the apartment, but how much it's going to cost you in transportation, driving to or from, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, you should put the transportation into the equation. And if you do, Well, then what are kind of the results you get in terms of what Americans are actually shelling out for their housing?
Well, a study done by a group in Chicago, whose offices I visited a few years ago, turns out that 48% of the people in this country, I mean, people are now paying 48% of their income for both housing and transportation.
That's the average of in the United States?
Yeah, right.
In other words, it is way above.
A little bit.
So in a sense, so there's the crisis is that the American people as a whole, on average, are living in housing beyond what they can afford, and that must mean that the rest of the things they need to buy...
They can't buy.
They can't afford.
In fact, the New York Times has reported that one half the people in their early 20s, their parents are helping them with their rent.
One half of people in their early 20s.
20s, right. And the Post reported that 50% of the 25-year-old to 34-year-old people, kids, were living with their parents.
50%.
This has not been this high since 1940.
Since 1940, when there was a real housing shortage,
right,
because of the Depression and then the war that was about to begin.
So it seems we have a little bit of a problem. And not only do we have a problem, the problem is getting worse as the years go by.
Can you give us some sense of why that is or how that's working?
Well, the interesting thing, if you look at Europe, you find that in Europe, the amount that you're expected to pay for housing is considerably less than what you are paying here. For example, in Europe, the Swedes pay 26% on housing.
That's what they're actually paying now.
Yeah.
So 26, let me just hammer at it, Walter, because this is really important. So Swedish people, on average, are paying 26% for their housing, and Americans are paying 48%.
Right. The Danes are paying 27%. And the EU members are paying 23%.
So Europe as a whole, half, as a percentage of income, half goes to housing compared to this country.
Right. So that's the problem right there.
Tell us why.
Well,
I know these are big questions, but I want to get at the core of these things. So why are we in such a mess?
In the first place, I think you've got to look to the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. The 10th Amendment leaves to the states all the rights not specifically given to the government, federal government. As a consequence, we have a lot of little municipalities in the United States. Every state has, little municipalities. And every one of these little municipalities has a mayor, has a city council, has a police chief, has a librarian, has... You know, everything
fire
on the
department,
fire
right.
department. And these are all funded from taxes, real estate taxes levied on houses in that area. So if you can have a rich area, you got a lot of taxes. So if you want a lot of taxes, you don't want a lot of poor people living right. in your neighborhood, right? So it turns out that as of now in the United States, there are 89,004 local governments. There are 3,000 counties, 19,000 municipalities, 16,000 townships, 12,000 school districts, and 37,000 other districts.
So we had a welter of these little institutions, each of whom can decide what tax to put on houses. So we allow a housing situation to develop in which one of the major costs of housing, whether you own one or you rent one, is the taxes you have to pay on it. And those are set by all these little municipalities. And your point is that this allows, for example, a municipality to say, let's have a relatively small number of people who are very wealthy, take big tracts of land, big, big expensive houses, and they will then be taxed at a rate which for them, being rich, isn't significant.
Right.
We can provide wonderful services for their children in the school,
right.
in the parks, and we can all do that and force people who can't afford to live in a community where correspondingly less will be possible to be raised and less services will be provided.
It's interesting. Matter of fact, in St. Louis County, there are at least 90 different municipalities.
In the one county around St. Louis,
yeah. This may explain Ferguson.
Yes, may explain why some communities
have nothing, really.
No, Ferguson, since they have all these costs for the cops and for the fire department and for the school board and for the schools, they were running out of money because 40% of Ferguson housing was underwater. And as a result, they told the police, go out and get tickets, give tickets. And
well, when you say underwater, they owed, the people who lived there owed more money on the
than their mortgage,
debt,
right?
Than the house was right. worth, so they couldn't pay taxes or they wouldn't pay taxes. So the city had no money, so it made people give tickets.
Right.
The cops gave tickets, and the situation blew up.
Yeah, exactly. That's what happened. The other thing, of course, happened was after the Second World War, we had this tremendous expansion of the Federal Highway Program under the guise of a defense. Improving the defense of the country. And I think up till as of 2012, the federal government built about 47,000 miles of highways. So this meant that if you wanted to leave the city, you could, and you could leave fast. The same thing happened in Ferguson. And Ferguson was one of the early suburbs, was the first suburb of St. Louis. It was on the first train stop outside of St. Louis. And when the highways opened up, the golf clubs moved out near the airport. And as a result, everybody moved out to the golf courses, left Ferguson empty. And this is all because the federal government had built an interstate highway system.
Right. And so this has always fascinated to me and been so important in American history. The government comes in and builds massive highways. The first thing, I'm an economist, so bear with me for a minute, Walter. The first thing this is a massive subsidy to the automobile companies. Everybody needs to understand, you only buy a car to the extent that there's a road to run it on.
Mm-hmm.
If there weren't roads, the attractiveness of a car would be much lower. And the need to spend money to fix it, if it were rolling over the countryside, would be astronomical. So what the government did was say to the car companies, we're going to create a market for that car you produce, GM, Ford, Chrysler, by creating a spectacular new highway system that you don't have to pay for. Wow. But then now your point. Not only does it create a demand for cars, it allows people, as you say, to escape the city. Anyone with enough money, and we know what happened in the 40s and 50s and 60s, as people left the city, those who could afford it, and moved to the suburbs, where then they would need a car to get back into the city.
A car?
Or two cars,
or
that's
three.
Right. Especially the more adults that
yeah,
worked,
right.
That's right. Especially because public transportation was everywhere limited or pinched. So you created the demand for a car. But what we didn't understand, those of us who saw that part of it, was that you also created now the opportunity for each little subdivision that decided it was a township or a school district or a city or a town or a village to set up its own desire of what kind of people it wanted.
Sure.
And everybody wanted the upper income people because they, you know, buy fancy houses and can pay the taxes. So you created the segregated patterns. And I don't just mean segregated by race, although that happened as well for the obvious reasons of our history at that time, but also segregated by income level, segregated by educational level. And you get this crazy quilt, which ends up producing for the mass of people a housing stock, because all of this affects how profitable it is to build a house in this area versus that one. Well, you put all this together, and the end result is what you've told us, namely that the American people are unable to afford housing and are suffering as a result of what they have to pay to get housing.
Of course, another thing that's happened is that our tax code. If you own a house or own a co-op, you can deduct the interest on your mortgage payment and your real estate taxes. So if you're paying a lot of money for taxes, what do you care? It's a deduction.
Right.
And it turns out that, what is it, the richest 20% of households receive 73% of these benefits.
In other words, the way the tax code is written is it's built in a kind of a inequality. Subsidy to the homeowner compared to the renter.
Right. And this subsidy is larger than what we have for any other group of people in this country.
So would you say, is the following then, am I reading you right, that we have created a system in which we have favored the homeowner over the renter? The homeowner ends up having less to pay as a share of his or her income than the renter
because they can get these deductions
and the renter can't.
Yeah, the lowest income people in our society probably can get, if they own a house, can probably get about a $400 deduction, whereas the richest group in our society, 73% of these benefits, they get $50 billion a year in deductions.
Tell me, how are we to understand the difference? What would you guess? Why are the Europeans able to provide housing to their people at a lower percentage? What would you get? Or why are we paying much higher? What's the disconnect in the way these two parts of the world function to make housing so much of a problem of affordability here for the mass of people? I understand the rich in both parts, in Europe and here, don't have these problems. But for the mass of people...
Well, Michael Moore made a movie called Where Do We Invade Next? I don't know if you've seen it, but it was very surprising. If you watch the movie, you find everybody says we. They're not saying me. And I'm sure if that movie had been made in this country, everybody would be saying me and not we.
So you think it's a more general sense of community or a sense of...
Yeah. The one scene that struck me was these motorcycle employees were punching out for lunch. And the guy said, where the hell are these guys going, man? He said, they're going home to have lunch. He said, going home to have lunch? Are you kidding? Well, I mean, after all, we have to have a decent meal, you know. So, you know, it's just a complete difference in attitude.
And you think that plays out by giving them a housing stock that is less costly?
I mean, if you want to go to school in Berlin, for example, you're German, you can go to college for nothing.
Actually, in Germany, they make a big point that it's available not only to Germans, but to foreigners as well. The last I looked, there are 25,000 American young people who have gone to Germany in order to register and get a four-year college education with no tuition.
Well, that's one of the reasons I'm doing my PhD program in Slovenia.
Yes, it's becoming a you know, the world is changing, to make a long story short. Okay, let me turn and push a little in another direction. What would you do if you were in a position to change, to contribute to a real wholesale transformation of the housing crisis, of the fact that we have, and I know we don't have the time, but to talk about the homelessness problem in this country, which, you know, living here in New York City as I do, I explain to people that when I leave my home, as I did today, to come to this studio to prepare this program, I stepped over sleeping people. This is in a city which is now experiencing below freezing temperatures for several days now. Put all that aside. Let's deal with the housing problem the way you've summarized it, that the mass of Americans really can't afford it. What do we do?
It goes beyond affordability. The first problem we have to address in terms of new housing in this country is climate change.
Okay. Oh, good. How does climate change play in?
There's a German standard of building housing called the passive house. And every community board now in New York City has passed a resolution that every building in New York City being built has to be passive house.
What is passive house mean?
It's a very highly insulated unit, and it's so highly insulated that you have to have an air handling unit in every unit to get fresh air in. Yeah. And so the utility costs are lower, and the amount of pollution is considerably less. So the first thing that we really need to address in any type of housing program is changing the way we build our buildings. The second thing we need to address is the whole problem of transportation. Now, we need to build housing where you have public transportation. You can have a car if you want it. but you don't need a car.
But let me stop you there.
Yeah.
So do we need to, in other words, to solve the housing problem, we need also to do something about mass transit. We are a society with very poor mass transit in an enormous part of our country. If I had time, I'd remind everyone now of the history of the automobile companies undoing the street railways, the bus systems, in order to create the demand for the private car, even though it's the major killer and injurer of people in our society, the major polluter of the air, the major waster of fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera. So you're talking about building houses near public transportation,
right,
but also then making public transportation, extending it, improving it, enlarging it, so that we can build houses where people could then afford them, partly because they wouldn't need a car.
Right. I think the other thing we could do if we build housing near public transportation is that we could begin to address the poverty problem and the segregation problem in our society. Because it's interesting, one of the leading ways to take people out of poverty is to get them to move, particularly in an area where there's public transportation.
There are studies that indicate if poor people are moved to a different neighborhood from the ones where they have been languishing,
right,
then opportunities open up.
Yeah, particularly for their children.
Right.
They may not themselves improve that much, but we know if they live in a different environment, their kids are going to not be the same as they would be. So I guess what I'm saying is that we have to begin to live more democratically, and which leads me to believe that we have to build housing which has skewed income levels.
And what does that mean?
That means that there are 40% of the people in new buildings, which are passive house, would be earning 60% of the area median income or less. And the 30% would be earning between 61% and 165% of the area median income, and 30% would be living above that, 165, right?
In other words, housing would become democratized in the sense of being composed of people at diverse levels of income.
Right.
How do you think the American people and the American culture would handle such
a notion? There's a model called limited equity. And in limited equity, you would pay to buy stock in a co-op. And what we could do is we could charge for the lowest 40%, we could charge one time their annual income. And for the middle 30%, we could charge twice their annual income. And if you earn over 165, then we could charge you 2.5 times your income. And then if we put the amount of money you have to pay on your mortgage, subtract that out from 30% of what you earn, the difference can go for the maintenance of the building, and you can pay your mortgage.
In other words, you would begin to apply formulas to the cost of housing,
right,
that are similar to the progressive taxation of our income that we have now. In other words, the income tax in the United States is progressive in the sense that it takes a larger percentage of people the higher the income they get. And we've accepted that for a century, basically. We've argued over what the rates should be, but the principle that the higher your income is, the higher the percentage you pay, has been accepted. So in a way, your proposal is modest here. You're saying that should be applied to housing in order to deal with the unaffordability of housing now, and it would also have a democratic dividend, you might say, in creating housing that is diverse and is not the way we do in this country now. Rich people live over there, middle income
right,
over there, and poor people left
behind,
with all the results that we know.
Now, the only problem is, if you have this kind of model, how do you lock it in? And the way that I propose locking it in...
Help us. What does lock in mean?
Keep it.
You
can't change it.
Okay.
What I've done is I've set up a corporation called the Trust for Affordable Housing. It's a 501c3 tax-deductible corporation. And the corporation is going to buy sites and lease the sites to limited equity co-ops with the income mix. And I figured out that if I do a mixed-use building, in other words, have three stories of commercial and the 100 units above of a limited equity co-op, that I can sell the apartments to each shareholder and probably end up with virtually no mortgage at all.
In other words, it's doable.
Yeah, I think so. Now, why do I have the leasehold? Because the leasehold determines what can be done in the apartment. The leasehold says you have to live in the apartment, you can't sublet it. And if you sell the apartment, fine. You have to sell to the same class that you bought it in. And if there's any difference between what the new AMI is and what
AMI?
Area median income, you get your money back. All the appreciation goes back to the building for maintenance.
Uh-huh.
So there's no profits. You get a decent place to live at a price that you can afford.
And you take out when you leave
only
at
what
least
you pay.
What you put in.
If it's over, you may lose.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, the AMI goes up. So you might get a modest, you won't get a modest return. Any return would go back to the building for long-term maintenance.
So if you live there for 20 years, then all the other people who sell while you're living there, if the value of the building goes up and so on, that additional value, because that's mostly
it's not the value of the building.
It's the value of the apartment.
No. It's the value of AMI.
Of the median income.
Right.
So if that goes up in the area. But what happens when they sell at a higher price than they paid?
They get their money back and the building gets the difference.
So they do get the difference.
No, they don't get anything. The building gets the difference. Right.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. So if you live in the building for a while, the building can improve its quality of life for you by using the growing
appreciation.
Oh,
the AMI.
You know, and that's an old idea, that the growing appreciation of the society is nobody's particular creation and should go for the housing stock available in a sense to everybody rather than be grabbed by a few people. So it has a democratic dimension that
way,
too.
You may think it's a little bit bizarre, but the fact of the matter is, suppose you had a car and you drive it for 10 years, and you're going to sell it for a profit? No, I mean, you know, you definitely. But if you have a house, you think it's some sort of illegality if you can't sell the damn thing for a profit.
Right.
So it's not quite as bizarre as it might seem. And I think
it changes. You need a change in mentality.
Yeah.
Walter, thank you very much. I hope you've shed some light for our viewers and listeners. This is Richard Wolff. We're at the end of this program of Economic Update. I want to remind you quickly that we look for you to be our partners. Make use of our websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info, and see if there are ways you can partner with us as we hope to partner with you. I want to thank again Free Speech TV for adding us to their menu. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis that has been a partner with us for a long time. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change.
Racism has never been only a practice of discrimination, outright violence, or a contest over resources. It has also always been a judgment, a discourse, a deliberate invocation of the term by others, and specifically by modern empires and nation-states and their ideologues and camp followers, to suggest the violent, irrational, and tribal antithesis of their civilization or nationalism that needs to be suppressed, managed, or contained.
This week we will hear a lecture by Rice University historian Osama Mqadisi, given at a conference at George Mason University last year, titled Sectarianism, Identity, and Conflict in Islamic Contexts. historical, and contemporary perspectives. Later in the program, we will talk to members of the young Palestinian Shuruq Debka dance and hip-hop group, currently on tour in the U.S. Do stay with us.
Last year, George Mason University hosted a conference titled Sectarianism, Identity and Conflict in Islamic Context, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives. The conference brought together more than 20 academics and policy experts to discuss sectarianism in an attempt to capture the complexity of sectarianism as a tempo-historically specific phenomenon rather than a static expression that can be explained away as an expression of religious dogmatism. Rice University historian Professor Osama Maqdisi spoke about the invention of sectarianism in the modern Middle East.
I'd like to begin with what I hope will be the opening line of the book that I will finish one day, which is the following. There is no history of sectarianism that is also not a history of pluralism. And I say this because the rise and the fall of religious diversity in the modern Middle East, and specifically I'm thinking of the modern Arab world, has shaped what is most profound, it seems to me, about this world, and what is most tragic about it as well. The notion of sectarianism remains, until today, one of the most overused and under-theorized concepts in the history of the modern Middle East. And when the exiled Syrian poet Adonis lamented in 1998 in a book of essays entitled A Preface to the Ends of a Century, when he lamented and he said, we are, quote, today less religious and tolerant and more sectarian and fanatical, less united and more divided, less open and accepting of the other and more closed off and obscurantist. His cautionary words evoked a disillusionment that is rampant, was rampant, and is in fact increasingly rampant and evident among many Arab intellectuals, and indeed among many intellectuals who think about and write about the contemporary Arab world. In what would become a familiar refrain in contemporary Arab commentary, Adonis wrote that the problem of the Arab world was almost entirely one of self. The Arabs had failed to secularize. They had failed, he said, to enter modernity. They had failed to free themselves from tradition. And the appearance, of course, of the nightmarish Islamic State in Iraq and Syria has amplified tremendously the sense and the sentiment of despair. So the conventional way of thinking about sectarianism follows precisely along the lines of Adonis's Jeremiad. This view depicts sectarianism as an age-old burden, one that gets passed essentially unchanged from generation to generation. Sectarianism, in this sense, is reified. It is made into an objective reality, and it is seen as an impediment to the unfolding of an idealized secular modernity. In 1959, therefore, the mid-20th century Arab intellectual, a pioneering Arab intellectual by the name of Constantine Zurayk, described sectarian fanaticism, or what he said, at-ta'asub at-ta'ifi, as something that, quote, intrudes into the present from the past. For Zurayk, like for Adonis decades later, sectarianism was an anachronism in an age of nationalisms. It was, in other words, the kryptonite which the colonizer uses to derail the march of self-determination, an inner demon, if a different metaphor, that has long haunted the Arab world. Now, as many of you know, we have journalists here. In journalistic and academic usage, sectarianism is typically evoked as an adjective akin to racism, so that we talk about sectarian outlooks, we talk about sectarian actions, sectarian thoughts, in a similar manner to the way one talks about racist outlooks, racist thoughts, racist actions. The term sectarianism thus often denotes a pervasive form of prejudice, or an identification with a religious or ethnic community as if this community were a political party. Sectarianism can also mean the mobilization through which political, economic, and social claims are made in multi-religious and multi-ethnic and multilinguistic societies. The political scientist Aaron Lippert famously in the 1960s popularized the term consociational democracy to refer to the ability of elites in particular countries that had a multi-ethnic or multi-religious component to create seemingly stable political bargains across sectarian or confessional or ethnic lines, such as the National Pact of Lebanon in 1943, French and English communal representation in 19th century Canada, or in the Netherlands. But the term sectarianism can just as easily be used, and in fact is most often used today, to denote outright communal mobilizations and warfare and violence. Whether we're talking about, from a historian's perspective, the Damascus Massacre of 1860, the Farhud in Baghdad in 1941, the Gujarat massacres, genocide in 2001, and of course the terrible aftermath of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Invariably, therefore, the description of sectarianism suggests a one-dimensional social reality that allegedly corresponds neatly to the religious and ethnic diversity of different parts of the non-Western world, and especially the Middle East. Just add geopolitics, and it's as if Middle Eastern pluralism is a bomb that must inevitably explode. I don't doubt that understanding, studying, tracing geopolitics is, of course, crucial to understanding the unraveling that has taken place in Iraq and that is taking place in Syria today. But to my mind, sectarianism has never been only a practice of discrimination, outright violence, or a contest over resources. It has also always been a judgment, a discourse, a deliberate invocation of the term by others, and specifically by modern empires and nation states and their ideologues and camp followers, to suggest the violent, irrational, and tribal antithesis of their civilization or nationalism that needs to be suppressed, managed, or contained. Its usage is similar to the way terrorism is used by modern states, not as an objective signifier of violence, but as an ideological signifier of a particular form of violence, invariably stripped of any meaningful context, directed at these states or their citizens. What I mean is that sectarianism is not simply a reflection of, quote, real fractures in religiously diverse worlds, but it is also a language. It is a discourse that has been deployed by both Middle Eastern and Western nations, communities, and individuals to create and justify political and ideological frameworks within which supposedly innate sectarian problems are contained, if not necessarily overcome. It is this point that I think we as scholars must be far more attentive to, namely the manner in which the sectarian is invoked and in the process invented in order to make particular claims to national unity and national resources, or indeed to deny the validity of these claims. Sectarianism, in other words, has always been as much a discourse about age-old social and religious realities than a description of their actual manifestations. Consider the fact that around the world today, very few groups, in fact no group that I'm aware of, openly identifies itself as sectarian. Indeed, because what we refer to as sectarian violence occurs primarily in places out there, in places such as Lebanon, Nigeria, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, there's a tendency in the West, and in the United States in particular, to dismiss sectarianism or to think of sectarianism primarily as a legacy of primordial sentiments, of deep and enduring hostilities that lurk in the allegedly unenlightened, barbaric, and uncivilized places of the world. President Barack Obama, in his recent April 2016 interview in the Atlantic magazine, repeated precisely this line of thinking. Expressing his disappointment with the Middle East, Obama declared, quote, "You've got countries that have very few civic traditions, so that as autocratic regimes start fraying, the only organizing principles are sectarian," end quote. When scholars such as Joshua Landis pretend in turn that the problem of the contemporary Arab world is that Alawite and Sunnite were placed in the same country by arbitrary European imperialism of the First World War, they seem to repeat an Orientalist commonplace, that diversity is an insuperable problem in the Middle East, but not in America, where blacks were enslaved in their millions, or in Europe, where, of course, Jews were dispatched in the horrors of the Holocaust. The Middle East, in short, and Muslims more broadly are thus routinely viewed as more negatively religious than people in the secular or allegedly secular West. In its coverage of the bombing in Pakistan in February 2013, for example, Reuters informed its readers that, quote, the schism, this is a way of talking about a bombing in 2013, quote, the schism between Sunnis and Shiites developed after the Prophet Muhammad died in 632 when his followers could not agree on a successor, end quote. That clerics cloaked in ostentatious piety often figure prominently in political discourse in the Middle East reinforces this association between religion, sectarianism, and the medieval. Sectarianism is, in other words, viewed in the West and in the Arab world itself as the Middle East's version of tribalism. But instead of tribes, the Middle East has religious or ethnic communities. Instead of chiefs, it has clerics or would-be clerics. Instead of a tribal problem, there is a so-called sectarian one. The rival theys, and here you can fill in with whatever community or group that you wish, Sunni, Shi'i, Muslim, Christian, Jews, Kurds, Alawi, and so on, they've been like this forever. That at least is what we are told. Think indeed of how easily we allow ourselves to use words today, especially in the U.S., Arab and Jew, as oppositional without thinking about when precisely this opposition began. Think also, more recently, in our own era, how not necessarily people here, but how in the media, Saddam Hussein has been reconfigured into a Sunni dictator, although, of course, he belonged to an Iraqi nationalist party that began decades before and was founded in Syria by both a Christian and a Sunni Muslim Arab nationalist who identified themselves specifically as nationalist, not as a Christian or as a Muslim. Think most of all about how Western journalism and scholarship in English about the Middle East routinely identifies people by their religious affiliation, no matter if they themselves identify themselves by that affiliation. So it doesn't matter what you say about yourself, you're always a Muslim or a Christian, a Sunni or a Shi'i. And it's routine, whereas, of course, we never do that in English writing when we refer to President Obama. You do not always refer to President Obama as, quote, the black or the African-American President Obama. You do not always refer to Hillary Clinton as the white Clinton. And that use of language, of course, has a massive and major framing effect. Now, many papers, as we heard in this conference, I suspect, will explore a range of episodes of sectarianism in medieval and modern contexts. And looking at the program, it seems different presenters will cover aspects of the medieval Islamic world to post-colonial West Africa and Indonesia to post-Ottoman Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia. My hope, of course, is that these papers will historicize, that is to say, contextualize, which is what I understood the point of this conference to be, to contextualize various sectarian episodes. My hope is that the aggregate effect will be to deconstruct this extraordinarily persistent myth of a perpetually sectarian East. Perhaps even more importantly, it will once and for all dispose of the idea that there is an analytic category called sectarianism, something with a capital S, that floats above history and that has analytic power. To be clear, I do not, of course, deny the salience of sectarian affiliations or the reality of mobilizations that have taken place in the Middle East. And insofar as we can discern a communal or caste problem in India and a racial problem in the U.S. and in Europe, then, of course, we can obviously also discern a sectarian problem in the Middle East. I disagree strongly, however, with narratives that suggest that sectarianism is either inevitable or to be interpreted as a Middle Eastern inevitability. So when the historian Bruce Masters, who was my mentor, and I respect him enormously, says that as long, quote, as religion lay at the heart of each individual's worldview, the potential for society to fracture along sectarian lines remained, end quote. Perhaps this is the case, but this is also a truism. Between the potentiality of sectarian violence and its actuality lies the work of historians, lies real history. That is to say, the workings out of myriad foreign and local factors, discourses, genealogies, that can and do transform one plausible, for instance, hegemonic national reading of the world into an equally plausible and hegemonic sectarian one. That is what history is all about. But it's not my task, or yours, I suppose, to explain or account for every instance of so-called sectarianism in the modern Middle East, let alone the pre-modern Islamic world. I do not pretend, of course, to do so here. Nor do I explore the myriad economic, social, urban kinship ties that make sectarian politics visible, viable, and meaningful in every instance. But I do think it is imperative to ask, is there really an unbroken relationship between the modern problems of sectarianism and the medieval ones that we are told over and over again is where the contemporary problem of the Saudi-Iranian clash today began as one between Sunni and Shi'i? I think not. I have no doubt, of course, that an argument can be made that there were in the medieval past sectarian tensions, discourses, and problems that need to be studied and explored by my early modern and medievalist colleagues. Yet as much as I look forward to learning about some of these histories here at this conference, what ultimately is the relationship between a medieval Shi'i and a modern one in Bahrain that can justify putting them together in the same conference? And I don't mean this as a criticism, of course, of the organizers. I understand exactly what the intentions of the conference as you laid them out, and I am in complete agreement with that. But in a sense, I ask, why is it that an academic conference on race relations in Great Britain today does not begin with a Norman invasion of William the Conqueror? And to put this question in sort of slightly less polemical terms, why is it that a conference on the problem of contemporary American racism, manifested by, for instance, Donald Trump, does not begin with an investigation into Cotton Mather, the Puritans' sort of view of Indians? Now, maybe there's a reason. Maybe we should do both. But the point is, we don't. Is the history of race relations any less complex or dynamic or violent or troubling than that of sectarian relations in the Middle East? I ask these questions, again, not to criticize or embarrass in any way, shape, or form the conference organizers, but to provoke some serious thought, at least for me, and hopefully among some of you, about how sectarianism is so often studied as a problem that spans the ages in one non-Western part of the world, whereas racism in America and in Europe is not studied in a similar fashion. The history of religious and racial violence in this country far surpasses that of any Middle Eastern country, and yet the term sectarianism has almost no political salience in the United States. Ask a U.S. historian about sectarianism here, and they'll usually give you a blank stare. What do you mean? It doesn't make sense. They don't comprehend. I suspect that part of the answer, of course, is one of vocabulary. But the other part is a difficulty that confronts all of us who work on the Middle East and on the Islamic world. That is to say, the enduring conceit that the Middle East is more religious in a negative way than the West. The Middle East has allegedly not secularized, that is to say, it has not followed a Eurocentric path to modernity, and thus in some respect, it is still somehow medieval, which is why I think someone like Bernard Lewis, a medievalist by training, has authority to speak so often about the contemporary Middle East. Now, whatever the medieval and pre-modern forms of sectarianism that existed, I do want to make the case here, and in a much more elaborate way I make the case in my forthcoming book, that the 19th century in particular ought to be or should be a key, or is, or was a key point of departure for any meaningful discussion of what we would call the problem of sectarianism in the modern Middle East. And I say this for three principal reasons. One, because I know something about it. No. First, because the breakdown in the 19th century of a long-standing and profoundly unequal Ottoman imperial system that had ruled for centuries over a vast multi-religious, multi-ethnic, multilinguistic landscape opened the ideological and political space for new political imaginaries, new horizons, and new vocabularies, some of which were inclusive and some of which were extraordinarily exclusive. The famous Ottoman Tanzimat reforms of the mid-19th century, between 1839, more or less, and 1876, disestablished a system of long-standing symbolic and legal Islamic Ottoman supremacy at a time of enormous European military, political, and economic pressure on the empire. Now, this is a story that most of you, I assume, here are familiar with. The question, of course, was what form of modern political organization was going to replace that of a discredited Ottoman Muslim dynastic absolutism. The 19th century witnessed the emergence in the Middle East of new ideas of a secular state, new ideologies of secular citizenship, as well as new ideologies of nationalism. So from legitimating a manifestly discriminatory Ottoman Muslim imperial politics, religion became a key to enshrining a new and increasingly codified non-discriminatory politics. This was one of the most obvious features of the Ottoman 19th century. The Reformation, the Tanzimat, the jizya tax, for instance, that ISIS reestablished in some parts of Iraq and Syria. The jizya tax was, of course, abolished by the Ottoman state in 1855. The Ottoman constitution of 1876, furthermore, formally promulgated an equal Ottoman citizenship, irrespective of religious affiliation. Now, in reality, of course, this transition from overt discrimination, from being a Muslim empire, to non-discrimination was an immensely complex and an immensely controversial process. In some quarters, there was resistance to the idea of equality between Muslim and non-Muslim. And it should come as no surprise that the major and unprecedented anti-Christian riots occurred precisely in this moment of transition. So in Aleppo in 1850, in Damascus in 1860. Rather than deny these, what we would describe today as sectarian episodes, in the manner of, let's say, modernist Arab nationalist historiography, which refuses to engage or deal or delve into these episodes, and rather than sensationalize them in the manner of an Orientalist historiography that has studied these events quite extensively, we should study and contextualize these events. So in my first book, The Culture of Sectarianism, I pointed out, or at least I tried to point out, how at the same time as the riots unfolded in Aleppo and Damascus, 1850 and 1860, the quasi-feudal old regime of Ottoman Lebanon, a non-sectarian regime, fell apart under the pressures of Ottoman modernization and European interventions that singled out the liberation of Christians as a key sign of civilization, emancipation, and non-discrimination. These interventions by both Europeans and Ottomans created new sectarian Christian and Druze geographies in Mount Lebanon that had not previously existed. They also encouraged a sectarian vocabulary of rights that helped precipitate a war between and among, and that's the crucial bit, between and among Maronite Christians and Druzes that culminated in massacres of Maronites in several locales in the summer of 1860. The violence that unfolded in the summer of 1860, in other words, had nothing to do with tradition, and still less to do with religion in any formal or theological sense. Instead, the violence had everything to do with a simultaneous European, Ottoman, and of course local overturning of a traditionalist, elitist order of things that saw fighting across and within communal boundaries. European powers seized upon the massacres of 1860 in Mount Lebanon, and of course a much larger massacre in Damascus in July of 1860, as proof of the impossibility of secular Ottoman citizenship or of the impossibility of independent Ottoman reformation. So in regions with significant Christian populations, such as Mount Lebanon, these European powers, and I'm thinking here primarily of Britain, France, and Russia, as well as Austria, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, pressed for the adoption of a modern sectarian quota system to guarantee non-discrimination, that is to say, a division of administrative posts along the basis of ostensibly equitable communal lines. And Mount Lebanon was made the setting for the first and most famous of these sectarian quota systems in 1861. This was the so-called Mutasarrifiyya that was established in 1861 by both the Ottomans, of course under Ottoman sovereignty, but with major European guidance. And the point of this sectarian quota system was not that it was going to reflect the old, but that it was going to reflect a new form of supposedly equitable governance. It was seen as a solution, however, to an age-old sectarian problem that was in reality of extraordinarily recent provenance. If this sounds familiar, it is because a very similar pattern would repeat itself in Iraq nearly a century and a half later. The most important point, I suppose, is that the creation in Mount Lebanon of the first formal Tanzimat-era sectarian system of politics in 1861 was not a natural or organic response to violence in 1860. It was rather an imperial interpretation of that violence that owed far more to the vagaries of imperial negotiations, to assumptions about the age-old nature of sectarian violence in the Orient, and specifically in Mount Lebanon, and to a balance of power that favored Europe over the Ottomans, than to any objective reading of the history of Mount Lebanon or the will of the inhabitants, who were in any case totally excluded, shut out of the negotiations that led to the inauguration of this first sectarian and anti-democratic quota system of 1861. The paradox of the sectarian system in the modern world is that they privilege religious affiliation as a sign of secular commitment to equality. And this is, I think, the crucial part. Sectarian systems are not religious, of course, systems. Yet their presence and workings out invariably cohere, justify, legitimate, and thus entrench communal solidarities at the expense of broader, overarching Ottoman or later on national ones. In the name of resolving ancient quarrels, they make acute problems chronic ones. They create elitist, in the case of Mount Lebanon, and this of course endures all the way until today, they create elitist transnational networks of patronage that create enduring dependencies on outside powers. Now, if the sectarian game is made the only game in town, one must play it or one will likely lose out. The larger point I want to make, however, is that across the late Ottoman Empire, so from 1861 until the very end of the empire after the First World War, there were other games, so to speak, that were being played, and they were being played with a lot more energy. Far more important and consequential than the stopgap sectarian experiment in Mount Lebanon was the consolidation of ethno-religious, or the emergence and consolidation of ethno-religious and linguistic nationalisms in the Balkans that systematically alienated and expelled Muslims, or at least made Muslims unwelcome, from new nation-states that were created in Greece and Serbia and so on, and Bulgaria. The crystallization of a late Ottoman Turkish nationalism, in turn, turned, as we know, cruelly on the Armenians and the Greek Orthodox Christian population of what is today the Republic of Turkey. Both Balkan nationalisms and young Turkish nationalism were secular in ethos insofar as they were not in any way religious movements. They rejected, however, sectarian mechanisms because they correctly associated them with a diminishment of their sovereignty. Balkan nationalism and Turkish or Ottoman Turkish nationalism embraced coercion and violence on a vast scale in their efforts to remove what they considered for the first time alien populations. So the Armenians were made into an alien population only in the late 19th century and into the First World War. The irony, of course, was that despite the episodic moments of sectarian violence in Damascus and in Mount Lebanon, earlier in the 19th century, it's in the Arab provinces, specifically in the Arab Levant, or the Arabic-speaking Levant, this area was actually extraordinarily tranquil until the outbreak of the First World War, until the very end of empire. The Arab, or what we would today refer to as Arab provinces, in other words, of the Levant, what is today Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, Israel, the Palestinian territories, and, of course, Iraq as well, remained Ottoman until the very end of empire in the sense of creating a space for Muslims, Christians, and Jews to elaborate a common civic Arabic culture. Now, of course, this is filled with contradictions and filled with elisions, which I can elaborate a little later. But the point I'm trying to make is that there was no existential crisis in what we today call the Levant, where ISIS today predominates. There was no nationalist question that emerged in this part of the world, unlike the Balkans and unlike Anatolia. The imperialism of the West that the Arabs faced was very different from the imperialism of the Russians and the Austro-Hungarians in the Balkans. And the Arab elites in the Levant, as a result, embraced the reality of Ottoman diversity under a diminished Ottoman sovereignty far more substantially, I would say, than either Balkan nationalists or the Young Turks themselves. And I think this is an extraordinarily important moment, the divergence of the late Ottoman Empire between the South, if we can call it that, and the North of the Empire. I'll skip over some stuff, but this brings to the second reason why the 19th century, those weren't reasons enough, there's a second, historiographically it seems to me, more important reason why the 19th century should focus our attention. Insofar as there was a problem of sectarianism in the Ottoman Empire, I've tried to make it clear, I hope to you by now, that this problem was neither uniform nor was it unique. In other words, to make this point, what happened in terms of anti-Christian violence in the Ottoman Empire, to study these sectarian moments of violence in the 19th century, we have to acknowledge them, first of all, and then we have to put them in a global context. So in other words, the global 19th century saw many states and empires struggle with new ideas of secular equality and citizenship. And there was a huge problem across the world of how do you transform systems of racial and religious discrimination towards systems of ostensible equality, irrespective of religious or racial affiliations. This was a problem that manifested in the United States, of course. It manifested in Europe, and it manifested in the Ottoman Empire, and of course in the colonial world as well. To put this point in the simplest, and I think even crude terms, although I think I can defend this a little bit more, at the same time as the United States struggled in very different ways with slavery and with the idea of black emancipation, and Europe in very different ways struggled with the emancipation of Jews, the Ottoman Empire was confronted with the question of the place of non-Muslims in what had long been an Islamic empire. The U.S., after all, endured a civil war and many bouts of race rioting involving the very question of black emancipation at precisely the same time as the Damascus massacre unfolded. And at the time as the Ottoman Empire witnessed unprecedented fragmentation involving sectarian mobilizations and eventually nationalist mobilizations. My point, of course, was not to make or pretend that non-Muslims in the Ottoman case were the same as black slaves in America or European Jews in ghettos. That's not my point at all. Rather, my point is to suggest that what race has been to America, religion has been to the modern Middle East. In other words, perceived as stable and obvious categories, but whose political implications, in fact, changed radically across the 19th century. In other words, if in America the question of race is defined and undergirded and contradicted and rendered ambivalent the meaning of U.S. citizenship, in the Ottoman Middle East the question of religious difference haunted an incomplete, paradoxical, and often contradictory 19th century project of equal Ottoman citizenship. The difference, of course, is not just that the blacks were slaves and were oppressed in an extraordinary way in this country. The difference, of course, between the Arab world and the West is that the Arabs have hardly affected, intervened, and transformed the nature of modern Europe or the United States in the 19th century to the degree that Europeans and later on Americans would transform, and of course still transform, the Arab world. And this brings me to the third reason why the 19th century must be a point of departure for framing our discussions of sectarianism in the modern Middle East. This was the era when Western imperialism began to assert itself as a major catalyst in the emergence of modern Ottoman and later Arab political cultures. There is simply no way to understand the history of anything relating to the Middle East, including what we call sectarianism, without acknowledging frankly how Western powers went from being factors, players, agents in what remained a sovereign Ottoman polity to becoming hegemonic architects of the post-Ottoman Arab world. There is, in other words, a brute reality of Western interventionism and imperialism in the Middle East that cannot simply be denied or mentioned and then moved on or obfuscated behind a rhetoric of self-inflicted wounds that allegedly really matter, as the late Fuad Ajami so tendentiously put it. Lebanon, after all, was created in 1920 by France to allow for Maronite Christian political hegemony. Syria, as you all know, was initially divided into separate Alawite and Druze states, as well as the state of Aleppo and Damascus. The British, of course, cultivated Assyrians in Iraq, and most egregiously, of course, in Palestine, they made that mandate the setting for the exclusionary settler colonial European Jewish nationalism of Zionism. But the point I'd like to end with is that we cannot reduce the question of sectarianism simply to a question of colonial divide and rule, because to do that is to ignore what I've been talking about earlier in the 19th century, the powerful legacies of the 19th century that predated direct European colonial rule over the Arab world, that gave colonial powers material but not raw material, because the 19th century had already reworked identities in major ways in the form of complex religious and communal and national identities. The Europeans also provided, despite all their imperialism, they still in the 20th century provided, by creating the map of the Arab world and these various states, they created a fundamental basis through which Arabic-speaking subjects themselves understood the opportunities and the limitations of a new European-dominated colonial age. My point is, to be clear, although Europeans created new Arab states on the basis of Sykes-Picot and on the basis of imperial interests in 1920 out of what had once been an Ottoman whole, this imperial partition could not prevent the continuation of an Ottoman era history. This history that we sometimes refer to as a Nahda, of a Renaissance, which is a term that's too diffuse, but that indicates this notion of the idea of an equal secular citizenship that began to take shape in the late Ottoman period. This imperial European partition could not prevent the proliferation of an extraordinary array of anti-colonial Arab voices that expressed new ecumenical and national solidarities that I don't think we can or should take for granted. These solidarities were expressed both in secular and religious registers, and they've almost never been studied together and given the attention that they deserve in the 1920s, in the 1930s, and the 1940s, into the 50s. I do think it is important, in fact, to note that the idea of being a Christian Arab in a political sense came to prominence at exactly the high point of European colonial divide and rule in the Middle East. I do think it's important that the idea of an Arab Jew comes at exactly the point when Zionism begins. I do think that the idea of Islam being a religion of tolerance comes exactly at the moment when there is an aggressive Western missionary assault on Islam. And when the Coptic canon Sergius preached unity from Al-Azhar in 1919, surely it behooves us as scholars and as people who are invested in the idea of an ecumenical Middle East to wonder not about the alleged false consciousness of someone like Sergius, that this is all fake, what he did, or it's all staged, but to ask how meaningful and how much part of the lived experience were the various Egyptian, Syrian, Iraqi, Lebanese, post-Ottoman projects of national unity that all, in a sense, derived from this Ottoman beginnings. It also behooves us, of course, to explore the tensions, the elisions, the contradictions, and the denials that are inherent in all these national projects. How, for instance, was Islam disestablished as a dominant religion in the region, and to what extent and through what forms? What does it mean that secular citizenship in the late Ottoman era was introduced at the point of a European bayonet? Why is it that a discourse of secular male citizenship became hegemonic and relatively uncontroversial? This is one of the most extraordinary stories, how uncontroversial secular citizenship becomes in the Arab provinces of the Middle East, whereas outright secularism and gender equality were and remain far more problematic. Why? Although all the mandate states in Egypt explicitly embraced secular citizenship, they also rejected or did not even consider the implementation of a secular personal status code or a uniform civil code. Instead, there remained an enduring paradox that is still evident throughout the Arab world and throughout the region. Secular citizenship on the one hand, and a highly gendered, newly codified, religiously derived, and segregated personal status communities and laws throughout the Arab world, and I believe South Asia. As far as I'm aware, most women's organizations that fought for female enfranchisement, women's enfranchisement and education, fought also for the reformation of personal status regimes, but they did not fight for the abolition of these regimes or their complete secularization. So to question anti-colonial nationalism became in the 1930s and 40s sectarian. If you questioned the nation, you were a sectarian. But if you accepted and partook in religiously segregated personal status regimes, you were not sectarian. And this is interesting sort of tension and contradiction in how this gets worked out. The coincidence, in other words, between the emergence of a codified secular citizenship and codified religiously derived personal status regimes was not I'm suggesting a contradiction. It was a relationship. It enabled both Muslims and non-Muslims, men and women, to participate in radically new and tentative and historic national cultures without feeling that they had to abandon or give up their religious affiliations and without imagining themselves, above all, to be sectarian. There is a reason, I think, after all, why it is only in the 20th century that the political Arabic term for sectarianism, Ta'ifiyya, was coined. It was coined, it seems to me, as an integral part of a new imagination of an equally new idea, Wataniyya, belonging to a nation, that accepted Muslims and Christians, until 1948 at least, Jews, as well as equal citizens under nominally sovereign political frames. So what I'm saying is that much like racism in the contemporary United States, sectarianism is a diagnosis that makes most sense when thought about in relationship to its ideological antithesis. To identify and condemn racism in America, in other words, one presumably upholds an idea of equality and emancipation. To identify and condemn sectarianism in the modern Arab world, one presumably upholds the idea of unity and equality between and among Muslims and non-Muslims. So I'd like to return at the end, in my conclusion, to Adonis and to the sense of despair expressed by him with which I opened my talk this evening. Is there any way to tell the modern history of the Middle East without reverting to a narrative of a place that is doomed to endlessly repeat its allegedly sectarian past? I hope by now you'll see that I, of course, think that there is a narrative, and there is a way. But to write this new narrative requires that we fundamentally change the way we think of, spatially, the idea of sectarianism, the problem of sectarianism. We need, in other words, to abandon, it seems to me, the traditional metaphor of the Middle East as a sectarian volcano always waiting to erupt. This place that, in other words, that has these deep identities that are just waiting for the conditions to come out. As any number of Western and Arab and Middle Eastern Orientalists and historians and pundits say over and over again. Because it seems to me that this metaphor of the volcano waiting to erupt tells me more about the poverty of the imagination of the pundits than it does about the imagination of people in the Middle East a century ago. There is nothing, in other words, permanent about identity, and there is still less that is permanent about sectarian identities. They are not waiting to emerge like desert locusts to ravage the Middle East periodically and inevitably. They are rather shaped, crafted, recrafted constantly. They are, in other words, in context constantly. We need instead, it seems to me, to think far more dynamically of different angles, of specific trajectories, of abrupt interruptions to these trajectories that produce new realities and new trajectories.
That was Rice University historian Professor Osama Maqdisi giving the keynote speech at George Mason University's conference titled Sectarianism, Identity and Conflict in Islamic Context, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives. You can watch the whole conference at jadalia.com. We'll put a link on our website at womina.org. From Pacific Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Beni bitirir, bu ayrılık. music, theater, and traditional folk dance have increasingly become an integral part of the Palestinian youth struggle against occupation and for preservation of the Palestinian culture and heritage. In 2012, Shuruq, Sunrise in Arabic, opened its door to Palestinian refugees in the Dahisha refugee camp in the occupied West Bank.
Shuruq is a new initiative inside the refugee camp, try to deal with the children's needs and try to build a certain kind of new leadership among the community, connected to the community, focus on the rights and the needs of the community.
Ziad Abbas, program director at the Middle East Children's Alliance, grew up in the Dahisha refugee camp.
The moment you mentioned the word Dahisha camp, two things jumped to my mind. It's a huge prison. The other picture jumped inside me. It's very, very strong refugee camp, very strong spirit, very strong soul. And Dahisha camp, actually, it's a pioneering camp for struggle against the Israeli occupation since 1948 until now. Dahisha camp, it was built by United Nations in 1950. Before that, actually, it was like just an area full of tents under the responsibility of the Red Cross. After that, in May 1st, 1950, the United Nations took responsibility. Dahisha camp, right now, it's around 15,000 people living on less than 1 square mile. This camp, actually, it was isolated from the main street first in 1979. The Israelis, they blocked or sealed 14 entrances. The people, they cannot pass with their cars across to the camp. Later on, they built a fence. So the people in the camp, they lived like 10 years behind the fence around the camp. The number of the people increasing in the camp. Some of the people, they leave the camp to live somewhere else, but the majority of the people stuck in the camp. And the only possibility for the people to build more floors. Until now, some houses reached the 7th floor. The camp growing up. If anyone look at the picture of the refugee camp right now, you will see a lot of water tanks on the roof of every house. And like my house, for example, we have 12 big water tanks to save the water because we are not allowed to access the water every day. The streets in the camp, it's very, very narrow. You can't drive 2 cars inside the camp. At the same time, where you go in the refugee camp, it's full of children because no playground, they have nothing. Actually, more than 50% of the people in the camp, they are children. In the camp, you have 2 big schools, 1 for girls, 1 for boys, from the 1st grade to the 9th grade. And this is called very crowded. Minimum, they have 40 students in each classroom. In the camp, we have 1 clinic, 1 doctor. This is a clinic run by United Nations, and the doctor worked for 6 hours. I did my own study 15 years ago, actually, about the camp. And this doctor, minimum, they receive 400 patients per day.
Berkeley-based Middle East Children's Alliance has been one of the major funders and supporters of Shuruq. Ziad stresses the importance of such cultural and social projects to people old and young trapped inside the confines of refugee camps under occupation. Middle East Children's Alliance has made it possible for 18 members of Shuruq Debka dance troupe, including 6 hip-hop musicians, to tour the U.S. and share their stories. Dina Al-Isa started dancing with Shuruq Debka dance troupe when she was only 11 years old.
I've been in Shuruq for about 5 years now. It's something that interested me a lot because I feel like it's a way of resistance. You're resisting the war, you're resisting the occupation, oppression through the dance. So dancing for me is a way to show our story, tell the people how it is to live in Palestine, how the Israeli soldiers treat people here, and it shows people, the people we are, and the life we had to go through, and all sorts of things that involve that.
Okay, my name is Mandar Issa. I'm originally from a village called Beit Aqab in Jerusalem, but I live in Dahisha refugee camp.
My name is Tamer. I'm from a village called Ras Ab Ammar, and I live in Dahisha refugee camp.
My name is Dalia Ramadan. I'm 15 years old. I'm from a village called Jrash, but I'm living in Dahisha refugee camp.
What is life like for these young people inside the Dahisha refugee camp?
The Israeli occupation soldiers attack the camp almost twice a week, arresting the children and youth and shooting the people. For example, last night they attacked the camp and they shot 5 people from the camp. Part of them are relatives to the dance group, so they wake up in a very bad mood and some of them was crying. Another girl was shot in Hebron. She is very close friend to 2 of the dancers. So this is our daily life. We live under occupation. Everything in our life is with occupation. One of the most things that children like here in America, we drove from L.A. to San Francisco for 7 hours. Nobody stop us. In our country, if you drive for 20 minutes, you will find checkpoints, walls, everywhere.
I'm a child, and I want to play. I want to feel free. But we don't have playgrounds. I want to study like every child in the world. But I can't because there is more than 40 students in one class. I don't have a playground. I can't do whatever I want like anyone. I can't travel like what I want. I can't move between the cities. Like every child have a talent and have something to send it to the world or to the people. Like to show it to the people, but I can't.
I think living in a camp is making everyone feel closed in. It's more like a prison than a temporary place. So you don't get to move around like any other human being. It's really hard to travel. Like, transportation is such a hard thing for people. You have to get permission to go to your own land. And that's what's hard because you can't visit anywhere you want. You have people from outside coming here, and they can go anywhere in your country, but you can't do the same when it's yours.
For these young refugees, dance and music is not only a political expression, but also a gateway to their past and future.
Shuruk was an initiative by Palestinian refugees who are struggling to end their continuous injustice, forced displacement. So at the beginning, we decided to make Shuruk in order to have a good place and facility for the children to express themselves through different kind of art and media.
كان في مخيم صيفي في مؤسسة شروق. وفي هذا المخيم الصيفي أعلنوا إنه في فرقة دبكة فأنا بكيت كثير أحب الدبكة فدخلت الفرقة أول ما تأسست وصل فيها للحين يعني 5 سنين.
She found out about Debka through her friends. She was in a summer camp and she found out about it and she really liked the Debka. So she joined the group to see how it is, and she's been in it for 5 years now.
I can send a message through Debka to all the world. I can tell people what is happening in the camp and what is happening for Palestinian refugees. And telling the story of the first intifada and how was the camp. It can make me defend for my rights and for my culture that the Israeli occupation is stealing it, so I can make it ours.
You bring all your emotions out in one movement. That one movement tells a story. By itself, it's telling a story of our ancestors and our land and what we had to go through, all that trouble and the struggle and the pain, the mourning.
We chose art as a tool to advocate for our right because art is a common language between all people despite their languages, religion, colors. And yes, we believe that through art our children can express themselves, especially that they are living really in very bad conditions in the camp. So we believe art is a very effective tool to express themselves and to raise our voices.
We are Shuruk Dance Group. We're from a refugee camp in Palestine. We are coming to the U.S. in March 2017.
Shuruk Dance Troupe's U.S. tour is named for Rofeida Abu Labban, a child in Dahisha refugee camp who was killed by Israeli soldiers during the First Intifada.
All our show talk about the First Intifada period in Dahisha refugee camp. Mm-hmm. So Rufaida was one of the children in Dahisha refugee camp. She used to search with the soldiers for the youth who are protesting or throwing stones on the soldiers. She was always in the front as a guard for the youth who are throwing stones to the Israeli soldiers who are attacking the camp, and they shot at her. She was 14 years old, so the same ages of the dancers right now. And also she was shooted at the same place that Shuruk exists right now. The first dance is talking about our life before the catastrophe and 448. Mm-hmm. And how we used to celebrate our good occasions through Dalauna. It's very famous music and song, Palestinian song. We use it usually in the Palestinian wedding. And then we go to the First Intifada in the Hisha refugee camp, and we talk through dances and through the lyrics of the songs about the situation at that time. And in the last song of the show, talking about that, we have to go back.
The Palestinian Shuruk Dabka Dance and Hip Hop group is currently on tour in the U.S. You can watch them perform on Sunday, March 19th at 4 p.m. at the Oakland Technical High School Auditorium in Oakland. For more information or to purchase tickets, please visit mecaforpeace.org. That's mecaforpeace.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Jim White, Sea Level Rise and the Melting of Sea Ice and Glaciers. On the most recent TUC Radio program, you heard Dr. Jim White present answers to the most commonly asked questions from climate change deniers. And you can find his helpful and intriguing comments as free download on TUC Radio's website at tucradio.org. In this part of his talk, Dr. Jim White turns his attention to ice, the accelerated melting of the Arctic sea ice and the ice caps of Greenland and Antarctica. Dr. White teaches at the University of Colorado. He specializes in global change, paleoclimate dynamics, and the human impact on climate. As paleoclimate scientist, Dr. White addresses those who belittle the effects of warming. He says that in Earth history, on average, every degree of temperature change is about 20 meters off sea level. That's a huge number, he says. Concentrations of carbon dioxide after water vapor, the most important greenhouse gas, are measured in parts per million. The organization 350.org expresses in its name that to be safe from catastrophic climate change, we should not go over 350 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. However, in late 2016, the measurements at Mauna Loa, Hawaii, went over 400 parts per million for the first time in modern history. And on March 9, 2017, the reading was 405 parts per million. When a visionary scientist, Charles Keeling, began daily readings of carbon dioxide from Mauna Loa in 1958. The concentrations were only 318 parts per million, and the pre-industrial age normal was 280 parts per million. Here's Professor Jim White. He spoke at the annual Weather and Climate Summit to an audience of weathercasters and meteorologists from the U.S. and Canada. They met in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12, 2017.
So I want to focus on ice. There's two simple answers here. One is sea levels rising, and will continue to rise to levels that are frankly shocking. Right? You know, when I talk in public, people will say, can you give me some idea of what it means for sea level rise? And I say, yeah, there's no more Miami Beach. And there's no more Miami. And there's no more Norfolk. And, you know, they look at me like I'm a little weird. No, they look at me like I'm a lot of weird. Because that's very difficult for people to digest, very difficult for them to comprehend. And I think one of the educational components that we need to do much better at is really educating people about this is how your planet functions. Your planet trades land, ice, and ocean all the time, and not in small amounts. Okay, and I'll try to quantify that for you. We do, however, need far better information on how fast it will occur and ultimately how far sea level will rise. But in red here is important. We know that it will rise and to levels that it will cause unprecedented damage and costs in the future. The second is sea ice is rapidly shrinking, and that is a potential weather trigger. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, Jennifer Francis spoke here. We've had her out a couple of times. There's a whole community now of scientists who look at polar change and try to map polar change into change that we see down here in the continental United States and at 30, 40 degrees north. And the evidence is getting stronger and stronger that as the energy balance of the Arctic changes, that impacts the weather that we have down here. It impacts how the jet stream functions. It impacts how rapidly storms move or how slowly storms move. It impacts how far cold air can exit out of the Arctic region. So there's a lot of things that are happening, and you all know this. The last, you know, 5 to 10 years have seen some rather unusual weather events. And I think that that's just, you know, we got to sort of buckle our seatbelts, put our tray tables up and go, okay, this is what's going to happen. We sort of figure out why and what's going to happen in the future, but I don't think there's any reason to expect that to change because the energy balance of the Arctic is changing quite a bit. Why am I so confident in all that? One is that water has a tipping point. Or ice has a tipping point. It's either ice at 32 or it's water at zero. And tipping points within the climate system are really important. When you hit a tipping point, you can have very rapid change. Whether you have snow on the ground, you know this. Whether you have snow on the ground and therefore you have more reflectivity, or whether it rained and you have water that goes into the soil, is very different. It's going to make a big difference to the weather for the next several days. And indeed, it's going to make a big difference to the weather for the next several months in terms of the climate. Second, warm water and warmer air melt ice. Right? This is how it functions. Third, warm water does expand, so there is a thermal expansion component of sea level rise. And fourth, it's physics. Right? This is not something you get to believe in. This is one of these things. Right? All of these things are going to happen. Polar changes are important to watch. This was discussed the other day. Why? Because polar amplification makes changes larger, easier to see, and the poles are where we expect to see changes first. All right, so in 2016, I pulled this off of NOAA, the Arctic had its warmest year on record, and that's driven by several factors. One is a decreasing sea ice, trading white ice for blue ocean, is a very, very big albedo effect, very, very big heat storage effect. And second, snowfall, as particularly in the shoulder months of the spring and the fall, when you have less snow in October and November, you have more heating, and you have less snow in April, you have more heating. And so those shoulder months are really important. As a paleoclimatologist, as a paleoscientist, we can track this over time. This is the way the planet has behaved for as far back as we can actually see. that if you look at, for example, that 2-degree change I told you 3 to 5 million years ago was a 6-degree change in the Arctic. That 4-degree change that you saw with no Antarctica was about a 12, 15, 16-degree C temperature change in the poles 40 million years ago. Right? So these are very big changes in the Arctic. And that factor of 3 or so, we call the polar amplification factor, has been active for a long time. And the reason why it's active is because it's basically physics. So you see snow cover changing over time. You guys know what that does. I won't talk much more about this, but permafrost is also decreasing. So permafrost is frozen land. We've had, for the last 10,000 years, some pretty stable temperatures on the planet. And they included a large chunk of Canada and a large chunk of Russia that were frozen. In those systems, in those really cold systems, it thaws out enough in the summertime that you get some photosynthesis. So there's land plants that grow up there. But then during the wintertime, when normally you would have respiration and that carbon going back up into the atmosphere, which happens here at 40 degrees north, that's not the way it works when you get that far north. It freezes up, and that carbon gets stored for the most part. And so really cold regions of the planet tend to store carbon over time. And indeed, permafrost has stored carbon at a rather large amount. There's about as much carbon stored in permafrost as there is in all coal, oil, and natural gas put together. And that's frozen. And that has that 32-degree mark set into it. It doesn't all freeze at once. You know, the good news is the physics still applies. It takes a long time to melt this stuff. You know, you start melting it to the surface, and you melt it down, and you melt it down, and you melt it down. It takes probably 100 years or more to melt permafrost. But once it's melted and accessible to bacteria who love to munch on this carbon, then this carbon starts to come out. It comes out as CO2, comes out as methane. We can talk about that more. But this is one of those feedbacks that as a carbon cycle scientist, we worry about quite a bit. It may be that, you know, what we do as human beings starts to get overshadowed by what the planet, by what the natural carbon cycle does as the permafrost systems begin to warm up. So trading seawater for land ice, this is how your planet works. What I've plotted here now, I stole this from Foster and Rowling in a Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, is CO2 and sea level. And you see CO2 varying from about 280 parts per million to about 180 parts per million. And that was that's the glacial interglacial kind of change. You go from about 280 parts per million down to about 180 parts per million. It's about 100 ppm change. By the way, I mean, you can do the math really quickly. So 280 to 400 is bigger than 100. And so we've actually increased CO2 in the atmosphere more than the CO2 decrease that accompanied the large glaciations on the planet. Now, those large glaciations weren't driven entirely by CO2. As a matter of fact, they were driven predominantly by changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun, which gave us less sun. But CO2 was a contributing factor. You see the very good relationship here between CO2 and sea level. Now, the scale here on the right is the one I want to focus your attention on. Zero is today's sea level. So when it got colder, that 6 degrees cooling on the planet that I talked about was about 120 meters of sea level drop on the planet. So you took about 120 meters out of the ocean of water, and you made it into Antarctica, and you made it into Greenland, and you made it into the Laurentide ice sheet, and you made it into the Finno-Scandinavian ice sheet, large chunks of ice. That was a very large change there. You also see that at various times in the past, sea level has been about the same as it is today. It's been maybe a couple meters lower, maybe a couple meters higher. The Eocene, about 40 million years ago, you've got about 80 meters higher sea level and about 4 degrees warmer. I've talked about this in the past, and this is one of my most, you know, I want to get out to the public messages. That 10 degree C temperature change that we had on the planet was accompanied by a 200 meter sea level change. All right, so you go from today into the past, 6 degrees colder, 120 meters. You go from today into the future, 80 meters, 4 degrees. So the scaling is not linear, but it's important to recognize that on average, every degree of temperature change is about 20 meters of sea level. That is a huge number. But that's what the planet does. Right? To the planet, this is no big deal. This is what we do on a regular basis, folks. This is how we handle things. Right? I think it's us as human beings who have built large cities. We've built huge amounts of infrastructure right on the coast, thinking that that sea level was going to stay where it was. No, it doesn't. Right? Whether we make the changes or whether the planet makes the changes, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that sea level is a very dynamic thing on this planet. Jim.
Jim Gandy, WLTX in Columbia, South Carolina. The sea level, that rise, that change, over what time period did that change take place?
I'll talk about that in a second. So we know that as you take CO2 out of the atmosphere down to around the 180, 200 parts per million level, planet cools off quite a bit, ice sheets can grow. You also see on here probably one of the more disturbing messages in here, and that is it's somewhere around 600 to 800 parts per million in the atmosphere of CO2 is when you have Antarctica as an ice mass or you don't, or you have 80 more meters of sea in the ocean. Right? So one of the more interesting questions is that we've watched Antarctica form, but we've not watched Antarctica go away. So Antarctica forming, all right, when you reach that 800, 700 ppm threshold, that got cold enough that you started to develop Antarctica. Right? Now, does that mean that when you reach 700, 800 ppm in the atmosphere, you start to melt Antarctica? And that's a fundamental question and one that I don't think we know the full answer to. Although, you know, if it went one way, I think, you know, precautionary principle would say, all right, it's probably going to at least be in the ballpark going in the other direction. We're at 400 today. Will we make 600? Will we make 700? Easily. I mean, if we don't change the way that we're doing things, we'll easily get to 600, 700, 800 parts per million. Right? We can make 1,000 parts per million. And we can do that in a far shorter period of time than we give ourselves credit for. You know, my kids, if they use energy the way that my generation used energy, they will need all of the coal, oil, and natural gas that we have in order to do that. And so you could very easily change the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by large amounts. So this is an important. So the other important thing to look on there is there's an amount of land ice on the planet that is dynamic, that can change quite a bit, and that's 14 meters. Once you go to, this is what's called the marine-based ice, and it can waste fairly rapidly. 14 meters is, again, something that's a problem. So a little bit more about marine-based ice. So there are parts of both Greenland and Antarctica that the base of the ice sheet is below sea level. That's unstable, what we call metastable. So this is particularly true in West Antarctica. Most of West Antarctica would be an ocean if the ice went away. Now you might ask, well, how do you even get ice there in the first place? Right. So, and the answer to that is twofold. One is that, remember, 20,000 years ago, sea level was 120 meters lower. So a lot of these large land ice masses grew at that time, and there was no sea level to bother them at that time. And then as the deglaciation occurred, as the Laurentide melted and all these other ice sheets melted, sea level rises, and you create what we call a metastable situation, where now you've got land ice that has its base below sea level. And it would, at some point, like to just dump that ice into the ocean and get back to what we would think of as a normal situation where the ice is floating in the ocean or the ice is melted into the ocean. And there's about 14 meters of that. Okay. This, I think, gets more towards, we're going to see in the second talk of the day, the declining ice mass in Greenland now. This is from the GRACE satellite. GRACE is a gravity-measuring satellite. And the gravity-measuring satellites, I think, is some of the best stuff that we have. It measures mass. And a lot of other satellites, if you measure the surface of an ice sheet, that surface of the ice sheet can vary depending on the density of the snow. So if you had you can make that surface go way up, but if you make it go way up with very light snow, there's not a whole lot of mass there. So I think mass is the thing to measure, and GRACE has, I think, helped us out quite a bit. Now, back to your question, Jim, about sea level rise in the past. Basically, as our planet has warmed up, The rate with which sea level is rising has increased, and that's perfectly sensible. That's physics. That's the way it ought to work. But we're seeing rise rates here of about 3 millimeters per year over the last 10 years, 15 years or so. That's actually relatively small compared to what the planet has been capable of doing in the past. So if you look at the deglaciation, you look at how rapidly was sea level rising throughout that time period, rates that are in the neighborhood of 3 times faster than that, 10 millimeters per year, are typical. And there are periods when you've got large chunks of ice that destabilize. We don't know exactly where these things are, but large chunks of ice that destabilize and go into the ocean rapidly, meltwater pulses, they're called. And they happen 2 or 3 times during the deglacial. So the sea level crawls along at this 10 rate, and then we'll go up to 40, 50. So 10 times faster than today. And this is something we've talked about in the past. We're looking at something like a meter sea level rise over the next 100 years or so. That's sort of conservative. This is what's going to happen. A meter in 100 years is something that, yes, we ought to really care about because it is really significant for coastal communities. But it's hard to get people really excited about that, even at that level. A meter in 30 years, that's a mortgage. A meter in 30 years is much more significant. And we think that that's pretty much the sort of the typical rate that the planet does when it starts to shed ice. And so this 14 meters, we think, rates of roughly a meter in 30 years, let's say 3 meters in 100 years, is probably what we ought to think of as sort of an average rate coming in the next few centuries. There are, of course, tipping points along the way there. The Federal Flood Insurance Program we could talk about. Either that's going to be the largest entitlement program on the history of the United States, or it's going to have to go away. Property values, this is a really significant issue. When you can no longer get insurance, what happens to the value of homes near the coast? And we know this. It's humans, we don't tend to do things in a nice linear fashion. This is more than likely going to be a run on the market kind of situation, so we need to keep an eye on that. And then, the people who actually know about this think about power. They think about roads. They think about sewers. And they think about freshwater availability. Many coastal communities still pull groundwater out of the ground for their drinking water. And as the ocean rises, the salt lens moves inland. And we've already seen many coastal communities having to go farther and farther inland for their freshwater. The estimate is that there's going to be about 150 million refugees by the end of this century. And certainly billions of refugees in the years after that. Right? I'm not saying those numbers to be shocking or to be provocative. I think these are pretty conservative kind of numbers. Now, what does 13 meters of sea level look like? This is Bangladesh with 13 meters of sea level. This is, one of those areas of the world that we care about from a refugee point of view. There are hundreds of millions of people who've got to go somewhere, and they don't really have anywhere to go. It's the reason why the Defense Department cares quite a bit about climate change and sea level rise. They recognize that these sorts of things are very destabilizing. This is Sacramento with 13 meters of sea level rise. So the good news is that California is going to get a whole lot more water to grow a whole lot more crops. Bad news is they're going to have to build a dam somewhere, in the San Francisco area to keep the seawater from going into this part of the world. Florida with 13 meters of sea level rise. And then Maryland and Delaware with 13 meters of sea level rise. Delaware approaches, whether we ought to just say, okay, we give up, we'll go to 49 states, and we'll just let that one go by the wayside. A new Arctic is here. The disappearance of summertime Arctic sea ice is faster than anticipated and has had profound changes. In tourism, has profound changes in shipping. So today, for example, we see lots of ships that sail across the Arctic every summer. This is and I've spoken about this in the past, and this is one of the things I talk about quite a bit when I give public talks. It's an intergenerational issue. So we put the 400 ppm CO2 there. Even if it just stopped there, let's just say by whatever political or economic means, we stopped at 400 ppm CO2. Our kids and our grandkids are still going to have to deal with the energy that 400 ppm CO2 wants to put into the ocean. So sea level is going to rise no matter what. Right? The only way to stop that would be to take CO2 back out of the atmosphere. And even then, as we're talking about, have we triggered those ice masses, those unstable, that 14 meters, have we triggered that already, and can we stop that? And we don't even know whether or not we can stop that. Very quickly, the loss of old ice is important for a very important reason. And that is, so you see here in 85 and 2016, the amount of very old ice. That very old ice is important because annual ice is something that can come and go very easily. The Great Lakes is a good example of that. The Great Lakes used to freeze every winter, thaw out every winter, freeze every winter, thaw out every winter. I'm using Lake Erie here as an example. In 1973, on February 27th, Lake Erie was frozen over. It's all red. 2 weeks later, it's melted out. You know, that's that 32 degrees Fahrenheit, that 0 degrees C threshold. So as soon as you've got enough warm water eating away at it, warm air eating away at it, a little bit of wind action, my message to you is keep an eye on the Arctic because it is set up to change. And when it does change rapidly in the summertime, and you've got a lot more heating in the summertime than you had before, then you're going to see some very interesting weather. You're going to see some very interesting phenomena that we haven't seen before, to be quite honest. So I keep an eye on that. Yeah. All right, finally, I just want to, I always end talks, and I'll do this until I die. I want to talk a little bit about ethics. I want to talk about, you know, the reasons why we do these things. Because we live on a water planet, we've talked about this extensively now, the impacts come after the causes by about 50 years or more, and that creates an intergenerational problem. Right? So we say we love our kids, but do we show it? And the answer is no, to some degree, right? If we understood, I think, the physics of the climate system, if we understood the delays in that system, we would understand this better. But the fact is that we are indeed saddling our kids and our grandkids with huge expenses. And we got a great life out of it. Right? I have a fantastic life because of the energy that was available to us as a society. But I don't think it's fair to leave the problems, the waste, if you will, to my kids. Right? Thought number two, population must be controlled. We don't talk about this, but this is something we need to talk about. So the best and most lasting way to deal with population, I've talked about this before, is to empower women economically and politically. And if you think about it, you know, as a human society, we males have dominated the system since time began. And the value of women in society still today in many third world countries is entirely around how many children she has. And there are parts of the United States where you can draw that correlation as well. Where women have political power, where they have economic power, two things happen. One is they tend to have fewer children per woman. And second, they tend to have those children later. Both of those things delay population growth and stabilize population. You don't need to do what China did, which is say you can't have any more kids. You can get to where you want to be by actually having more equity between men and women. And third, everyone has to care about a shared planet. As I pointed out, we got about 1.5 billion people without shelter. You got about 2 billion people who don't get enough calories or don't get the right calories. They're going to care about whether or not they can feed their kids. They are going to care about whether or not they can put shelter above their kids' heads. They're not going to care about what fuel they use. They're not going to care about whether they're cutting trees down. They're not going to care about the environment because they need to survive. So you cannot have a situation in which you've got 5 billion off here utilizing the planet the way we are and the 2 billion over here struggling to survive because those 2 billion are going to change the face of the planet regardless of what the 5 billion do. So at some point, you've got to think about equity. You've got to think about we need to bring everybody up to at least some point where they can care about our shared environment, right? And so with those three thoughts, I will stop. Thank you so much for listening.
That was Dr. Jim White, Director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. He spoke about sea level rise and the melting of Arctic sea ice and Greenland and Antarctic glaciers. He spoke at the annual conference of the Weather and Climate Summit before meteorologists and TV and radio weathercasters. They met in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12, 2017. And you can find the YouTube channel of the Weather and Climate Summit online. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
In the years between 1915 and 1970, almost 6 million black American citizens from the South migrated to northern and western cities seeking freedom and a better life. Our guest is Pulitzer Prize winner Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. This book tells the untold experiences of the African Americans who fled the South over three generations. In the first of two interviews recorded from Isabel Wilkerson's home near Atlanta, Georgia, on September 28, 2012, she begins with a description of the biggest untold story of the 20th century.
Describe it as the greatest untold story of the 20th century because it went on for much of the 20th century. It began in World War I, did not end until the 1970s, and resulted in the relocation, the outpouring of 6 million African Americans from the South to all points north and west. It involved every state outside of the South. They went as far as Maine to Alaska to escape essentially a caste system. This was not a move. It was, in fact, a defection from a caste system, a seeking of political asylum from an artificial hierarchy that held them within the grip of certain kinds of things that they could and could not do based upon what they looked like. And so this was, in some ways, a defection that went in some ways unnoticed in the ways that it could have, because it went on for so long, and also because the people themselves did not talk about it because there was so much heartbreak and pain associated with their decision or their feeling that they had to leave their homeland for other parts of their own country.
Beginning in approximately 1915, going on up through 1970.
This was the only time in American history that American citizens were forced to or felt that they had no other option but to leave the land of their birth or parts of their own country just to be recognized as the citizens to which they had been born. No other group of Americans has ever had to do that. And this migration began in large numbers because of World War I, which was when the North had a problem, a labor shortage, in which they needed labor because the war was going on in Europe, but the European immigrants who had been working the factories and the foundries and the steel mills
were no longer coming in such large numbers. Immigration came to virtual halt from Europe, and so the North looked for the cheapest labor in the land, and so that took them to the South, where many African Americans were actually working for no pay. They were working as sharecroppers, and so the first arrivals came to the North and the West at the express invitation of the North, which needed the labor.
So when it's called the biggest untold story of the 20th century, what are your thoughts on why it has been untold?
It's been untold for many reasons. One is, from a journalistic perspective, it was a hard story to tell because it was going on for so long. Journalism, which is focused on what's happening that day or that week, tends not to be able to as easily capture something that went on for generations. When it began, many of the people who would ultimately be writing about the first people arriving, because it was written about during World War I when it was first occurring, many of those people had retired or had passed on by the time the migration ended. It was the entire time the migration was going on, people expected it to be over. It would be over after World War I. It would be over during the Depression. It would be over before World War II began. People expected it to have been over. And so at each stage, people were misjudging the determination of these people to get to what they perceived as freedom. So from that perspective, it was not captured in the way that it could have. From the standpoint of the people who were actually doing the leaving, they didn't necessarily announce what they were doing. These were people who were leaving as individual families, much like any immigration experience. These were one family added to another, making, you know, millions of people departing a particular place. And they didn't announce that they were leaving. Many of them actually had difficulty leaving to begin with. The South didn't make it easy for them to leave. The South put up many barriers to their departure. They would arrest people from the railroad platforms. They would arrest people from their train seats. And when there were too many people to arrest, they would literally wave the train on through, so the people who had been hoping for the chance to leave actually had to watch the train go without them and figure out how now would they get out. And so they didn't make an announcement about what they were doing. And even after the fact, they didn't share with their children all that they had gone through, their hardships and all that they had endured and suffered, because there was a sense of heartache and shame attached to what they had endured, and they didn't tell their own children. They didn't want to burden them with all that they had endured. And so the stories were not necessarily told even across generations, and so it remained quietly kept and unresearched in the way that it might have been, because the people themselves didn't want to talk about it.
Well, let's talk about the understanding of that experience, that the act of leaving was the most significant measure of migration. Can you elaborate on that?
When you think about the world that any immigrant or migrant is leaving, and you think about all that they're enduring and what it takes to get the courage and the resources to leave, you realize that the act of leaving itself is so dramatic that it in itself is the point of the freedom that they're seeking. These people were all seeking freedom like anyone else who's ever crossed the Atlantic in steerage, across the Rio Grande, or across the Pacific Ocean. And it's that great courage and fortitude and the vision that they have, and in fact, the desperation and determination that they have, it often gets lost in any discussion of it. And I think that you have to remember, I think, the world that they were leaving. They were leaving a world in which was actually against the law for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together in Birmingham. They were leaving a world in which throughout the South there was actually, in courtrooms throughout the South, there was actually a black Bible, an altogether different white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in court. They were leaving a world in which it was actually against the law for a black motorist to pass a white motorist on the road, no matter how slowly that person was going. And they were leaving a world in which every 4 days an African-American was lynched for some perceived breach of the caste system that they were born into. And so they, when you think about the world that they were leaving and what they were seeking, you realize that the act of leaving itself was in some ways an act of a kind of a revolutionary act, because this was the first time in American history that the lowest caste people signaled that they had options and were willing to take them. It was the first time in American history that they actually could choose where they would live and what they would do for a living. So it's a revolutionary demographic sea change and turning point, watershed moment in our history, and the act of leaving was the whole point for many of them, just to get free.
Did you find in your interviews that those conditions existed up until 1970, the time that's been identified as the end of the migration?
Yes, the migration ended in the 1970s when the initial conditions, the primary conditions that had fed this migration came to an end, when finally the South began to implement the laws that had been passed in the 1960s.
When you talk about what was prohibited, passing someone on the highway, playing checkers, those prohibitions de facto, if they were not actually laid out in the law, existed up through the 70s?
Yes, there was a resistance to implementing the law, and one example of that was in Prince Edward County, Virginia, in which despite the requirement to integrate the schools, the county decided to just close the school system altogether rather than to integrate. And so this went in there. You had an entire generation. For 5 years into the 1970s, there were children who were not able to go to school, African-American children who had to move to other counties, or they simply did not go to school for 5 years. And so this was a world that did not begin to change, in de facto change, until the 1970s, which gets into the lifespan of many, many millions upon millions of people alive today.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Isabel Wilkerson from her home near Atlanta, Georgia. She's the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Well, Isabel Wilkerson, if I may, I want to ask you a horrible question. You mentioned people being lynched every few days. Can you describe that, what that means, what lynching was?
That's a really good question. I think the idea of exploring what lynching really means is important for people of today, because I think over time we've lost sight of what the word actually means. And what it means was that an individual would have been captured and accused without the benefit of the law or of the court system, accused of some breach, usually, of the caste system into which they had been born. And they would be usually tortured before they were eventually killed. And that many of them were hanged, some were burned alive, some were dismembered. This was a horrific part of our country's history. And this went on for many, many decades and generations. And the 2 decades leading up to this migration and the decade immediately following the beginning of this migration, an African-American was lynched every 4 days for some perceived breach of the caste system I've described. And the more common reason for lynching was actually not for the more spectacular cases that we do hear about, the cases such as Emmett Till, in which an African-American might have been accused of an untoward remark toward a white Southern woman. Those are the more spectacular cases, but the more common reason for lynching was for the amorphous accusation of acting like a white person, which could mean anything. It could mean not tipping one's hat, not stepping off the sidewalk fast enough, walking into the wrong door, the side door as opposed to the back door. Whatever was perceived as a breach of the artificial hierarchy that had been created to maintain the economy and the structure of life in the South as they had known it.
And after the torture and the killing of the individual people, there was no judicial retribution against the actors?
Generally not, or overwhelmingly not. And when there were, they would be facing an all-white jury, which would acquit them, and generally they would say that this killing occurred at the hands of persons unknown. That was the general resolution of any of these cases. It should also be mentioned that these lynchings usually occurred in front of many thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people. There was a case of a young man named Jesse Washington in Waco, Texas, in which he was burned alive in front of 5,000 people. So generally, a lynching would have been a public spectacle that involved the torture and eventual killing.
And the same fate was likely to befall anybody who protested the lynching?
It would have been, and therefore there was very little protest of any lynching because there were consequences for anyone. That's one of the things about this caste system. It was such a force in the structure of life in the South that there were consequences for anyone who, on either side of the caste system, on either side of this dividing line, there would be consequences if anyone broke ranks with this prevailing system. So there was a tremendous amount of pressure on people on all sides to maintain the role that they had been born into, which meant that there was a loss for everybody because a tremendous amount of force was necessary to maintain it, and that meant that there was a loss of time and energy that could have been put into other things, but instead were put into enforcing an artificial hierarchy.
Well, Isabel Wilkerson, let's talk about the significance of the measure of the act of leaving, what that takes. Perhaps you could share the story of Arrington High, who published for many years the newspaper called The Eagle Eye.
Arrington High was one of the unrecognized warriors in what might be considered the pre-civil rights days. In other words, the civil rights movement that we think of the 1960s actually had precursors. There had been people who had been protesting and resisting this caste system for generations. But it's as if they were trees falling and no one there to hear them. And he was one of the people who was protesting and resisting many years before we would know about what would be called a civil rights movement. So here we are in the early 1950s, and he's in the isolated precincts of Mississippi, and he's protesting what he has discovered to be some breach of the caste system from the other side. He's discovered that some white politicians have been frequenting brothels that were primarily African-American. And he had discovered other things that he would write about in a broadside. It was basically a sheet, a newsletter that was exposing the realities of life in the South at that time. And for doing that, he was punished by being committed to what was called an insane asylum in Mississippi. Once there, other activists who had been aware of his plight began to try to figure out what could they do to help him get free. And so thus went in place this elaborate plan to get him out. And this story is so inspiring, I would think, because it's an indication of what it took for, on the one hand, to get one man free, what it took for any of these people really to get out and the dangers that they faced in doing so. But also it's inspiring because it's an indication of how people on both sides of this dividing line came together quietly and with determination to do the right thing in freeing someone who had been falsely accused and basically imprisoned to condemned to a life in an insane asylum. And so what it took was it took an effort on the part of whites and blacks to get him out. And what they did was they created a caravan of cars that went on to the property of this isolated insane asylum, which went over many hundreds of acres, and they communicated to him somehow that they were going to be coming. He positioned himself in just the right place for them to come. There were five cars, four driven by white motorists, white drivers, and one driven by a black driver. He got into the car with the black driver, and they then went very slowly to get to the exit of this insane asylum, which had been, of course, walled off and very difficult to leave. And because there was a white car leading and a white car behind at the end of the caravan, they were waved on through and they were out. And they continued on their path to get him out of the state of Mississippi. And they got to the border of Alabama and Mississippi. And there he was told to get out of the car and cross over into the other state, where there was yet another set of five cars to carry him to the next place that he was to go. And then he was taken to a funeral home and directed to get into a casket. And he made his way out of the South and out of the caste system to freedom by getting in the casket, and he escaped inside the casket on the train to get to Chicago.
The other story that I'd like to ask you to share, Isabel Wilkerson, is the story of George Swanson Starling, who left the South, arrived in New York, and worked on the railroad as a conductor. And what he was able to do after the passage of the Civil Rights Act with regard to how African-American people were expected to move from one part of the train to another.
That's fascinating that you would bring that up. Well, one reason he's yet another person who is an indication of the quiet resistance that was occurring throughout the South all these generations before what would ultimately become known as the Civil Rights Movement. You might say the crescendo of all of this effort toward freedom. And he had been working in the citrus groves in the 1940s, a time when the country was at war and thus had great need for labor. And at that time, he was actually agitating for better wages and work conditions for the people who were picking citrus fruit. He had had a couple of years of college and was quite good with math, and he could see how poorly the people were being treated. And so he became, in some ways, a union organizer, although there were no unions allowed. And for his efforts to try to get these individuals to band together, he actually got on the bad side, the wrong side of the grove owners, and he was forced to flee because there was a plot against him, a plot to lynch him for what he was doing by rousing up the pickers in the groves. And so he was forced to flee in the 1940s, and he fled to Harlem, to New York, where he then began working as a railroad porter. His job as a railroad porter took him back and forth to the South, although he very rarely went back in the early days to the town that he was from, but he went back and forth to the South. So he had a chance to see the migration unfolding, these millions upon millions of people leaving the South with all their worldly possessions and sometimes chickens too, as they were heading north. And he actually lived to see and worked on the railroad long enough to see the ultimate outgrowth of all this, which was the civil rights legislation in the 1960s. But interestingly enough, there was no announcement to the people who were actually going to be benefiting from these changes. So a lot of the people who would get on the trains did not know that they actually could move now from the segregated seats that they had been accustomed to, that they could actually sit anywhere on the train. And many of them were afraid to take that leap into a part of the train that they had never been in before. And so one of the things that he set about doing quietly, and he had to do this very quietly because he himself could have gotten in trouble if it had become known that he was doing this, is he would actually alert them when they got to the South and they got to the border crossing that had been there before, Washington, D.C., going north and south. And he would let them know that they no longer had to stay. They no longer had to sit where they were accustomed to sitting, that they could actually sit anywhere on the train. And he had to let them know that. And they were not aware of it. And sometimes they would question him. And he almost got in trouble for letting them know that the rules had changed, that they could actually sit anywhere they wanted. And that was partly because the trains themselves, the conductors, did not go out of their way or actually do anything to enforce this new law because of a fears that white Southerners would not still want to sit with them, even though this was now the law. So I think this gives a window into how slowly these new laws were actually put into effect. This was not an overnight thing where suddenly people could sit anywhere they want and thus began to do so. This was a very slow unfolding of the freedoms that had been fought for so long, and he was he was right in the center of that effort to try to ease these people into the new freedoms that they themselves were afraid to take on.
The sense that I read from your section about George Starling and this portion of the of his work on the railroad is that he was a teacher. He was almost a crusader to get people to understand the freedom that they legally had on the railroad.
I think that he had always been a teacher. He had been seeking to, in quiet, unrecognized ways, teach the people who had been the citrus pickers in the 1940s that they could actually ask for a nickel more box for citrus fruit that was going to go on to the open market for $3 or $4 a carton when they were only getting 12 cents for what they were picking at great peril to themselves because they had to climb into 40-foot trees in order to obtain, to get the citrus fruit. And so he had been doing this all of his life. There was something in him that actually was an activist for social justice, but he never really had the opportunity to do it in a formal way. And so he did it in the ways that were available to him. And he took it upon himself to let people know that they could sit anywhere on the train, that they didn't all have to cluster together in the places that they had been accustomed to. And he took it upon himself to alert them to that. And I think that it was people like him who helped to ease us into the modern era as we know it.
Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, I want to thank you for being with us on this first of a series on Radio Curious about your book that tells the epic story of America's great migration of African-American people from the South that occurred in our country between 1915 and 1970. Before we close, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. And one is about an epiphany, an aha moment in your life that has guided you.
One epiphany or one moment that occurred for me that I can't even imagine not occurring. I can't imagine what would have happened if this had not occurred, which was the discovery of the words of Richard Wright, which gave a title and a name to this book. When I discovered those words in the footnotes of his autobiography, Black Boy, suddenly all that I had been working on, I spent 15 years on this book, but all that I had been working on, I discovered it around year 12 or 13 of a 15-year odyssey of working on this book. When I saw those words, I realized then what it was that I was doing and what the story was and how very urgent it was. And I could see it from the words of someone who had actually lived it and had spent much of his career, really all of his career, writing about this heartbreak and longing and dislocation that comes with migration. And suddenly it hit me what it was that was my mission in completing the book, and it gave this tremendous velocity to what I had been doing, and it actually helped me get to the finish line. And so the words, the warmth of other suns, come from the words of Richard Wright, and that was a huge epiphany for me.
And if you could share with us what you would like to do with the remainder of your one precious life.
I want to continue this work of hopefully helping people see the importance of social justice. My goal is to win people over one heart at a time through the use of language and the use of characterization. The goal of putting people in the hearts and the minds of people who they might never otherwise see or see themselves in, and to recognize that we all have so much more in common than we've been led to believe. And to have people look at someone who they might never imagine themselves being or having anything in common with and seeing what would it be like to be them. And so that's what I want to continue to do.
And finally, Isabel Wilkerson, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I recommend a book called The Arc of Justice by Kevin Boyle. It's the story of a man who migrated from Florida to Detroit. He was a physician, and he wanted freedom as any other American would. And freedom for him, beyond the migration itself, was to be able to have a bungalow in a nice neighborhood in Detroit. And so it's a story of longing, of heartbreak, of seeking the American dream, and what happened in this one city in the 1920s. And it's almost, it became a forgotten story until this book came out. And that's the book I would recommend.
Isabel Wilkerson, I'd like to thank you for being with us on this edition of Radio Curious.
Thanks so much for having me.
Isabel Wilkerson is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. The book she recommends is The Ark of Justice by Kevin Boyle. This program was recorded on September 28th, 2012.